described becomes. The sense that the West has to do something. There's a rather good piece by Ben Wallace in one of the newspapers today that simultaneously makes an incredibly strong case for intervention while also making it crystal clear how hard and potentially fractious intervention by the West, and remember it's a West led by the supremely incompetent and unsuitable Donald Trump, would be. So how do you police the tension between feeling that we must do something and not knowing what that something is?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the head of West Midlands Police has admitted AI was used to justify banning Maccabi Tel Aviv football fans from a game at Aston Villa last year. An intelligence report that led to that decision referred to a game that never actually happened. Craig Guildford has now issued an apology to MPs for evidence that he gave last week. LBC's Midlands reporter George Ike is following developments.
They'd included erroneous evidence about a game between Maccabi Tel Aviv and West Ham in a report to the Birmingham City Council Safety Advisory Group to decide whether they should prevent supporters from attending the game at Villa Park. We now know that the reason for this mistake was because of an AI program called Microsoft Copilot. And whilst offering a profound apology, Craig Guildford said his belief is that there was no intention to mislead the committee.
Iran's top judge has suggested people held over the anti-regime protests there could be executed. It's despite Donald Trump's warning that he will take very strong action if that happens. The government has dropped plans requiring people to sign up to its own digital ID system to prove they can work in the UK. Ministers now say other forms of ID, like biometric passports, will be accepted when it becomes mandatory. The Conservatives have branded it spineless, saying it's Labour's 13th U-turn since coming to power. Shadow Foreign Secretary Priti Patel has told LBC it's embarrassing.
Well, they claimed that the digital ID was going to stop the boats, if you recall, and stop people smugglers and all this kind of stuff. We have laws in place already, and the only thing that will stop that now is effectively a strong deterrent to stop illegal migrants from coming to our country. It just shows what a shambolic government we have. They just make these spurious announcements without any detail. By the way, that proposal for digital ID was going to cost £1.8 billion. I mean, the totals just keep on racking up.
The Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, has denied that it's a U-turn, saying claims that it is are political mischief from opposition parties. Plans have been revealed to build a new railway line between Birmingham and Manchester, but the government has given no timescale for the project. And the Chancellor has confirmed that pubs will receive more temporary support on business rates. Landlords have raised concerns over the upcoming increase detailed in the budget. Rachel Reeves has said that an announcement will be made in the next few days and weeks. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 were trading up 21 at £10,159. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather cloudy with patchy rain for the southeast today, dry and breezy elsewhere with a high of 9 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Sounds like Arjun is going to wake up feeling fresh. And it's a good job. Because he's got a big presentation to nail just down the road. Get better sleep for your money. Book your next workstay at Premier Inn.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. The time is 3 minutes after 10, and the focus of the world, for good or for ill, is currently directed towards Iran, or at least the focus of our world, of the world in the West that is interested in current affairs and geopolitics. And I don't know what confidence felt like. Did we used to have confidence? Do you remember Robin Cook, Foreign Secretary in Tony Blair's first government, and his determination to institute something called an ethical foreign policy? Does this happen to you? Do you get haunted by things, thoughts, ideas that you don't think about for years, and then they come back round again and sort of slap you in the chops like a wet fish. Robin Cook, a fascinating politician. Resignation was on a point of inviolable principle as well, I think. But it was this determination to introduce an ethical foreign policy, a bridge, if you like, between the often absurd idealism of what is sometimes unfairly referred to as the far left, many of whom, of course, remain supportive of the hideous regime in Iran, and the pragmatic left, those who recognise that you can't do anything unless you achieve power. Although Keir Starmer currently establishing a third branch of Labour ideology where you achieve power and then do nothing. Historically, you have the idealists who don't care about power. They care only about ideological purity and the delicious aroma of their own flatulence. And then you have the pragmatists. Robin Cook, I think, tried to build a bridge between the two when he talked about an ethical foreign policy. So you can't stop. You can't defy gravity. And less so now, but certainly in his pomp, the West sat atop the world order. And that is a fact of gravity. So if an oppressive, a repellent regime were to be overthrown, then it would almost always involve Western intervention. But Robin Cook dreamed of a world in which that intervention would be ethical. I don't know what that means. I mentioned to you at the beginning of the week that I'm somewhat baffled to find my opinions becoming less pungent on many issues as I get older instead of more pungent. The tradition seems to be that you become more certain of things as you get older and possibly less thoughtful, but possibly we're starting a little fight back against that tradition on this programme. But the notion of an ethical foreign policy popped into my mind this morning when I found myself, shall we say, contemplating the unlikelihood of Donald Trump accidentally doing something good for the world. So Donald Trump now telling Iranian rebels who are being murdered both judicially and extrajudicially. By that, I suppose I mean extrajudicially means being shot dead on the street, and judicially means being hanged for protesting, which is scheduled to begin today with a protester called Irfan Soltani, who is to be killed for peaceful protest. And you have Donald Trump promising that help is on the way. So the help is being offered by the head of an administration that looks increasingly envious of regimes that are free to brutalize and even kill their own members and their own civilians should they have the audacity to dissent or to protest. Punishing people who are telling the truth, of course, is becoming a bit of a hallmark of Trump's regime. But we are still happily a long way from a world in which there are any really meaningful or deep parallels to be drawn between Washington and Tehran, Trump's Washington and the Ayatollah's Tehran. So there's a strange thing that happens at moments like this. I don't know what it felt like at the time. Do you remember what it felt like when George W. Bush essentially set his sights on Saddam Hussein? They talked about the axis of evil. Were we paying proper attention then? Did we all buy into the idea that invading Iraq was somehow payback for September the 11th, despite the fact that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with September the 11th? Al-Qaeda hiding out in the Hindu Kush, led by Osama bin Laden, a Saudi, who would have found much of what Saddam Hussein represented repellent. Was that what took hold? Back then, I was just coming out of a career as a showbiz journalist, so I wasn't paying quite as much attention to the geopolitics as I as expected and keen to do now. But did we all buy in subconsciously to the idea? Was the propaganda machine? Robin Cook resigned, to go back to his memory, I'm pretty sure, over the thing that I'm now trying to recall. I think he resigned on a point of principle over the unjustifiable nature of that war in Iraq, and yet on we went. Did we buy that subconsciously, or did we just somewhat xenophobically think that all Middle Eastern people or all Middle Eastern Muslims must be the same, and therefore if we can't go after the people who actually did September the 11th or masterminded it, then let's just go after some others that we don't like the look of? Why Iraq? On whose side we had been, or in whose support we had been full-throated during the Iran-Iraq war just a few years previously. So What on earth are we supposed to do? And clever people and informed people like Ben Wallace write articles under the headline, "We cannot stand by as the brutal Iranian regime crushes protests." And stupid people who understand nothing, like Donald Trump, tell Iranian protesters that, quote, "help is on its way," without specifying in any way what that help might be, but reports contend that he is considering strikes against the Islamic Republic, language like pay a price, killers and abusers, help is on its way, take over your institutions, followed by three exclamation marks. Behaviour that would, you know, get you killed in the United States of America, never mind in Iran, but Trump won't be anywhere near the ground when those consequences are felt. But they end up sounding as if they're on the same side, don't they? They end up sounding as if they're on the same side. We cannot stand by as the brutal Iranian regime crushes protests. Donald Trump has told Iranian protesters that help is on its way as he considers strikes against the Islamic Republic. And given that I've just cited a former Labour Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, it's interesting that Ben Wallace cites a former Conservative Foreign Secretary, Douglas Hurd, who once said that if you want to understand the Iranians, they are like the French. By which he means that they have a kind of proud nationalism, but also what Wallace describes as a wonderful attitude of constantly challenging authority. He provides quite a winning example. For example, it is illegal in Iran to have a satellite dish, and yet everybody has one. You could lead quite a nice life in Iran, even under this hideous regime, and you could feel as if you were standing up for your principles and even occasionally speaking truth to power. It seems, under certainly Wallace's analysis, that it's almost the whimsy of the Revolutionary Guard that puts you on the hit list. You could be opposing the government. You could be opposing government policies. You could be refusing to wear the coverings that are mandated by the regime. You could be a woman running a business. You could have media and citizens publicly challenging politicians. They have strikes. They have industrial actions. They have protests. And according to Ben Wallace, who visited the country often, ordinary Iranians never mentioned Israel when I would visit. And then you have the other, the parallel universe in which terror is the mode of government. You get classified as a security threat or a threat to the revolution for whatever reason, often corrupt. You could be tortured, shot, or hung from a crane in front of a crowd that we wouldn't be able to tell from outside whether it was cowed or baying or part of some sort of Potemkin project. That's how the Islamic Revolutionary Guard runs, rules the country. And it makes me wonder whether this, what are you going to call it? This Western status quo, this sense that you feel oddly, or at least I feel it, and I'm currently speaking for you, that the West has a role in these sort of situations, that the hideousness of the Iranian regime acts as a sort of yin to Western yang, and that we are morally required, that an ethical foreign policy demands, that somehow natural justice requires that we in the West, where the most powerful men are currently championing and defending technology that allows perverts to undress children, we in the West have a sort of moral authority which entitles us to endanger, imperil, even kill, or cause the death of Iranian protesters because we are so certain of our superiority to the Iranian regime. So what I'm feeling today, to put it in shorthand, is we can't just let this carry on. We have to do something to help these protesters. This regime is abominable. This situation is intolerable. We must do something. And that's where I think today's conversation starts. We must do something. And you say we must not do something, and it sounds like you're defending the regime. Is it really our place to wade into Iran and start doing things? replacing what is currently there with something else, currently unspecified, possibly the son of the former Shah who was kind of inflicted upon Iran by American imperialism and then rejected by the Iranian people. I just don't know how you square this circle between something must be done, and it must be done by us. It feels a bit 19th century, that, or at least first half of the 20th century. It must be, it wouldn't be us anyway, would it? We would just be either rubber stamping America's action or being completely ignored by America if we decided not to support it. Which brings us back to Douglas Hurd's characterization of France, doesn't it? Because they, like Robin Cook, opposed the Iraq War. For all the good that it did, they were on the right side of history, I think we could probably agree now. So you can't even use the word the West in a sort of homogenous sense. Is it why? Why? So a couple of early messages coming in saying we must do something. But I don't know if you can say that we must do something if you can't tell me what. And I don't know that any of us are qualified to say what. So Ben Wallace, a former Secretary of State for Defence, and probably one of the only names that springs to mind from very, very recent times, who you might describe as the face of respectable conservatism when the Tory party didn't seem to be run by crackpots, weirdos and racists. He talks about stuff I don't understand. Offensive cyber capabilities to shatter the information shield that the mullahs and their lackeys are trying to wrap around the Iranian people. We can cripple the communications of the oppressors. He describes powerful capabilities, but insists he doesn't mean boots on the ground. And we could be easily persuaded to back anything as a population, as we saw during Iraq. I don't even mean that as an insult. We don't control the chains of information. We are customers, if you like, clients for them. But I just get a little bit concerned when I see saber-rattling, not even in the first instance, and this might change when I start taking your calls, but in the first instance, I don't care that it's Donald Trump rattling the saber. I think it makes me more concerned, more worried about what the consequences might be, because you have such an obvious imbecile rattling the saber, while also, of course, increasingly terrorizing and brutalizing his own population. But it's not new to him, is it? This isn't a phenomenon that begins with Donald Trump. If George W. Bush was in power, if Bill Clinton was in power, Barack Obama, I don't know, really. Dropped the ball on Syria, I think many people would argue. But again, how do you justify Western intervention, Western supremacy? 0345 6060973. Look at Iraq, look at Libya, look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, look at Rwanda, look at Yugoslavia, even closer to home, and try and point to a place or a time where this kind of intervention really worked, at least in the short term, really delivered improved. So here's the point, I don't know. And I'd love to know what you think. Again, as on Monday, if you have a connection to Iran, if you have history, family, any form of connection with the country, your position becomes more interesting, not more valid necessarily, because there'll be somebody else with the same connections who holds a completely different position. So you don't sort of win intellectual or emotional primacy simply by dint of proximity, but you probably know more about it than the rest of us do. So for that reason, you might be more interesting. But if you were to print a T-shirt or erect a billboard that said, "We must do something," or "something must be done." Four of the most terrifying words in the English language, because they really are at the very top of the arsenal of idiots. Something must be done, but I don't know what. I'm just going to shout. It's like the purview of the radio phone-in host of old, isn't it? Something must be done! Just don't ask me what. Something must be done, but I don't know what. Two questions for you. Why the West? Does the West's historical sense that it has a role and a duty in these sort of scenarios, does that still hold true today? 0345 6060973. And entry level question, if something really must be done, what should that something be? All right, 0345 6060973. So I suppose that's it, really. What should that something be? And is it actually true that something unspecified must be done? So you can either specify the something, or you can address the question of the must. Is it actually true? Is it still the role of the West? And then perhaps the identity of the man currently occupying the White House does become pertinent. Because the last thing you want to do is sit here sounding like you're an apologist or a defender of the Iranian regime. You can leave that to people like Jeremy Corbyn. But equally, if you say don't do anything, then you're sort of saying leave them to it. Can you navigate that tightrope? Because I'm not sure I can at the moment. And underpinning all of it is this, here you go. Finally got there. Should this be the West's business? And if so, why? 03456060973. Should any of this still be the business of the West? And if so, why? If not, why not? Hit the numbers now. You will get through.
LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like from Real Octopus Energy calls.
Octopus are an absolute breath of fresh air.
The customer service is really good.
People like yourself and all of your colleagues have done such a wonderful job.
Your customer service was tip-top. You know, I couldn't fault it.
You stepped it up, I think, for an energy company, so well done.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running.
From rusty chains to fancy frames and everything in between. Sign up for British Heart Foundation's iconic London to Brighton bike ride. Because it's not your wheels, it's how you use them. Whether you're a brand new rider or seasoned pro, challenge yourself this June and make your ride matter with British Heart Foundation. And you won't need any fancy gear, just your helmet and your bike. Sign up today, search London to Brighton Bike Ride and keep us beating.
You know how fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because sound is the most effective way to tell the players they're rubbish. Works in advertising too. Because when you amplify your advertising using radio, your campaign is 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
21 minutes after 10 is the time, and something must be done is the order of the day. Help is on the way is the headline. We cannot stand by as the brutal Iranian regime crushes protests. I wonder if I'm actually asking you whether or not we are allowed to agree with Ben Wallace. We cannot stand by as the brutal Iranian regime crushes protests without knowing what it is that we should be doing. It's the job of politicians to tell us what it is that we should be doing. Unfortunately, the politician in the hot seat at the moment is Donald Trump, one of the most ridiculous and dangerous individual ever to occupy the White House, certainly in living memory. Anyway, there you go. And as I said on Monday, I will say it again now, that wasn't a bad introduction for someone who is not a Middle Eastern expert, but do not feel constrained by the questions I have asked. If you know more about this subject, you have strong feelings, deep understandings, then just ring me on the usual number and talk to me about it. Ash is in Leicester. Ash, what do you reckon?
Good morning, James. Hello. Thank you for taking my call and shine a light on this again. The case of Iran, as previous callers have explained throughout the days that you've been speaking about this, is that it's quite different to other countries like Iraq and Syria.
Yeah.
And that's because of the way that religion plays a part in Iran in comparison to the rest of the countries that we've spoken about. My worry at the moment is that Trump, if you remember earlier on, threatened that if the demonstrations start, if the government starts shooting, we'll start shooting. That position very quickly changed to if they start executing people, then we'll get involved.
Mm.
And then there was a talk that, Iranians want to negotiate. Now, that is an incredibly dangerous thing for the Iranian people because, as we know by now, Trump will do nothing that doesn't sort of benefit himself and line his own pockets one way or another.
Do you know, even now, I hesitate to say some of the things out loud that pop into my mind when we talk about Donald Trump, but they could buy him off.
that, That is absolutely not beyond the realms of possibility.
how far and how fast we have fallen. You could literally have a scenario in which, via some back channel, they offer Donald Trump. So, I mean, you could do it out in the open, like Qatar did with a jumbo jet. But you, anyway, so I've interrupted you with one of my flights of fancy. I'll shut up for a while. Carry on.
No, that's absolutely fine. So you're absolutely right. I mean, as we said, yes. If there is benefit for Trump in this, he will negotiate, quote unquote. I hate using that term now. He will negotiate. He will get something that works great for him, will make him look decent because perhaps the crackdown will quiet down for a bit. But what that would mean by negotiating and coming to any sort of agreement with this government, it would mean that the regime will stay in place. Trump comes out winning, and the blood of the Iranians that are being spilled by the dozen every day is going to go to waste.
Yes.
By the thousands, absolutely. Now, the other thing that really makes me worried is that Netanyahu, when there was strikes on Iran, he came out, addressed the Iranian people, raised his voice that this is all about, you know, the Iranian people and the freedom. Mm. And he is now silent, which means to me that they are really positioning themselves to negotiate something that will benefit Trump and the United States in the long run. Now, again, with to talk about what the
British he said once the regime fails, Iran and Israel will become partners again after the regime in Tehran falls, two or three days ago. But as you say, and as Ben Wallace says in this rather good piece in the Telegraph today, that there has subsequently been surprising silence.
That's it. And the other silence that I'm incredibly worried about is our government currently and people like Keir Starmer, who need to be stood up and sort of...
Because this is the point. I'm wondering whether we're going to hit 11 o'clock today and we're all going to very reluctantly agree that something must be done, but please don't ask us what.
Well, let me put it this way to you. Nigel Farage has been popping his head up and taking part in demonstrations and making his voice heard. Tommy Robinson has been very vocal on this and has been interviewed by Iranian news outlets that are outside of the country, so independent news outlets that are outside of the country.
Well, he will be currently doing, I don't know how many people are aware of this, he will be doing whatever the UAE want at the moment. That seems to be where his current grift is concerned.
That's where the money's coming from at the moment, apparently.
I think
now, and the worry is, so the Iranian people at the moment are looking for any voice from outside of Iran to be amplifying this cause, and therefore they are giving platform to people like these two to just amplify the voice. And that is happening right now because there is an absence of voice and leadership from Keir Starmer and his government at the moment.
Now, what would the voice say, though? Just for people who don't follow the work of Hope Not Hate as closely as I do, they've done some fascinating investigations into what why little Tommy Ten Name seems to have redirected his attention away from tatty flags on roundabouts and towards quite complicated Middle Eastern geopolitical issues. There's some detailed and fascinating but very dispiriting reportage on their website. What do you actually want him to say? Because I'm only half joking, Ash, when I say something must be done, but we don't know what. So Keir Starmer must say something. But what? He's been pretty outspoken. Yvette Cooper even more so in condemnation of what's going on. What words would warm you more than the words we have already heard?
So unfortunately, words, there is no, when you're dealing with a dictatorship, words mean nothing.
But he just said he has to find a voice.
Yeah, I know. What I mean is actions. My apologies.
Oh, right. Okay.
So basically, what I need, obviously, yes, we want him to come out and be vocal about this and constantly talk about this as an Iranian. That's what I want to happen.
Yes.
But so let's talk about prescribing the IRGC. Now, it was spoken about yesterday and the day before about the reasons why we don't do that and the laws that we're looking at adjusting and changing to be able to prescribe IRGC. That will be an incredibly important step because, first of all, as Omid Jalili has been explaining as well, I'm not sure if you've heard of this, this will certainly mean that their assets will be frozen, for one. It will also mean that in the future, once this revolution goes through and happens and people are victorious, is that these evil people cannot then just run around wherever they want and take their money with them. They will be held accountable.
I worry slightly about interrupting you because you're obviously, you've got more invested in this, but my understanding is that proscribing the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, actually requires legislative change, and that they have said this week that they are examining how to change the law. So you can't announce something that is illegal. And it is currently more difficult to proscribe the IRGC for legal reasons than it is, for example, to proscribe Palestine Action, which is in the news an awful lot. So I'm almost feeling guilty now about this idea that we all feel something must be done, but none of us know what. Because even what you've said, with your deep knowledge and investment, emotional investment, historical investment in your country of origin, your family's country of origin, you're calling for something that can't be done at the moment.
Yeah, so unfortunately, this is something that perhaps should have been looked at a long time ago.
But pushing
this through is incredibly important. The other thing is the embassies. We need to shut down the Iranian embassy here. We need to shut down the
British
embassy.
Does it hurt them, though? Does it hurt them? They've called the ambassador in, which is always an interesting turn of phrase. Does it hurt them? I don't know. It's an interesting one.
I mean, apart from taking military action, these steps are the things that will, at the very least, show that the British government is on the side of the Iranian people and is doing something.
But it isn't really doing so. And that's why I asked what difference it would make, because they've already been proscribed by Canada and Sweden. I'm sure you know this. And while the United States has designated it as a terrorist organization, and yet it hasn't limited their powers or clipped their wings, as far as I can tell from the scenes that we're seeing in Tehran, one jot. So, I started off as almost an air of mischief, Ash, this suggestion that we're all going to end up agreeing something must be done, but we're not actually going to be able to say what. And I wonder now whether that slightly mischievous suggestion is hardening into a probable, as opposed to a possible conclusion. But thank you for educating me and everybody else listening. It's 10:31. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
The head of West Midlands Police has apologised for giving MPs false information over the decision to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from a football match at Aston Villa. Craig Guildford says there was no intention to mislead about a security threat and has blamed AI. Officials in Iran say there will be fast trials and executions for people detained in anti-government protests. Donald Trump has warned, though, that the US will take very strong action if people are killed. And the government has dropped plans requiring people to sign up to its digital ID scheme. Other forms of ID, like biometric passports, will be accepted instead to prove people's right to work in the UK. LBC weather, cloudy with patchy rain for the southeast through today, dry and breezy elsewhere, a high of 9 degrees.
LBC.
Did you know Vets for Pets are
the nation's most trusted vets?
We think that's because they're
locally owned
and locally loved.
Wherever you are,
we've got a vet local to you.
Vets for Pets. We're all for pets. Based on a survey. To verify, search vetsforpets.com/allforpets.
On your marks, get set, go hybrid. The new Toyota Aygo Cross Hybrid. More oomph than a Friday feeling. And smoother than your last online date. More confidence, more go. In a new hybrid engine with 0% APR representative over 24 months. The new Toyota Aygo Cross Hybrid. Visit your nearest centre. Stephen Eagle, Toyota Horsham. Price from £21,595. Available on Toyota PCP when financed through Toyota Financial Services by 31st March 2026. Optional final payment indemnities may be required. See website conditions apply.
Get your home entertainment sorted with deals on EE's award-winning bundles.
Why is it award-winning?
Because you can flex between your subscriptions like Netflix, Discovery, Now, and TNT.
Sofa sessions?
Sorted. Oh, yeah. Plus, it's powered by ultra-fast full-fiber 150 on the UK's best broadband technology. With absolutely nothing to pay up front.
Nothing?
Nice.
Offer ends 29th of January.
New customer, 62% UK availability. Terms apply.
You know, sometimes you just want to mosey. Travel your own road.
slow things down a mite, meet the locals, and smell the coffee. So friends, take time to sit down with the folks at Little America and let them tailor-make your trip to Canada and the U.S. just the way you like it. For slow travel that nourishes the soul, head to littleamerica.co.uk.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345-6060-973.
It is 10:34, and it is an absolutely defensible, even logical position, but it is not a watertight one. It's not a penetrable one. You watch the scenes in Iran, or you read about the scenes in Iran, you are horrified and disgusted. You are, and that leads you to conclude that something must be done. It's why perhaps some people, both inside and outside Iran, regardless of the character of the person saying the words, would welcome Donald Trump's promise that, quotes, help is on its way, end quotes, although, as Ash reminded us a minute ago, his position changes like the weather. And yet, when you try to pin down what that help would look like, everything falls apart. Everything except the conviction that something must be done. We are human beings, aren't we? We're not robots. Well, I mean, an awful lot of contributors to this conversation online will be robots, of course, but we're not robots, you and me. We're human beings, and we're capable of cognitive dissonance. We can hold two contradictory thoughts in our head at the same time. And this isn't quite cognitive dissonance, but it's a close cousin to hold two simultaneous thoughts in your head that something must be done, but I've got no idea what it is. And that means, of course, that the and that politicians are charged with almost the impossible. Demir knows what we're talking about. He says, as a Bosnian, I can attest that foreign intervention will bring quick but not lasting results. That is Bosnia, but also, of course, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan. This should not be the business of the West, because the West has no stomach or stamina for the long-term state building needed to mold fragile states to meet our imaginary standards of democracy, human rights, market economy, etc. I don't know that I would agree entirely that those standards are imaginary, but I'd certainly agree that they're fragile, Demir. And he concludes, however brutal the regime is, it's up to people of Iran to overthrow it. I mean, that's a really clever contribution. And if you marry it to Ash's call a moment ago and some of the contributions we took on Monday, unless the West gets everything, unless it actually signs up these territories as outposts of empire, which was the 19th century model, then Demir's analysis is absolutely right. We have neither the stomach nor the stamina, or possibly the money, to engage in the generations-long process of building stability and building society. So instead, we bet the house on characters like the son of the last Shah and just sort of cross our fingers and hope that stability will follow. And the lessons of, as Demir reminds us, Bosnia, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, are either forgotten or ignored, or just somewhat blithely glossed over because of the impossibility of reconciling something must be done with stating in detail what that something is. Yasmin's in Twickenham. Yasmin, what would you like to say?
Hi, good morning, James. Well, hello. Some of it's covered by what you've just said about the chap who mentioned about Bosnia, etc. Yes. But we mustn't go in there. We can't go in there. We can say it's to please ourselves and our electorate to say that we're going in there because of right of protest. They have a right to protest. But whereas our right of protest is being diminished in this country, it's being diminished in America, and that's okay. But they,
well, it's not. It's not okay. I'm not going to accuse you of whataboutery, but neither the UK nor the American governments are murdering thousands of people and hanging them in public for protest. There are some parallels to be drawn, but I think that they're currently largely irrelevant to the conversation that we're having about whether or not, and I'll remind you of the words,
sure,
we can stand by and do nothing.
Well, the thing is, what we have done, dialogue has got to be the only option, really. Where has any of this got us before? With you might say, what about we again? We did it to Iraq. We did it to Syria. Cameron sent weapons for the people of those countries to fight in Syria. And those weapons ended up in ISIS hands.
So I mean, just say it then. I won't accuse you of what about. Just say we should stand by and do nothing.
Yeah. we have to stand by, and dialogue is the only answer. Bringing Iran back with the nuclear proliferation treaty
is very important. You can't have a dialogue with a regime as corrupt as this one. I mean, you can, technically, but you can't negotiate on good faith.
We already do with others, James.
You can't negotiate in good
faith. This regime is completely out of control, I understand. But I don't see how going in there, attacking them is going to help. Did it help when...
No, I think I agree. I mean, in some ways, I agree with you, but I haven't reached morally or emotionally the place where I can say we must do nothing. I'm still saying we must do something. But you asked me what?
And I think your heart and a lot of people's heart says, let's go in there and help these people. And that's what the heart should say if we're decent, moral people.
Let me do but what I did to callers when we were talking about Gaza, and then you can accuse me of whataboutery.
And
I would say to people, and I take no pleasure in having been proved hideously right about this, I would say to people, well, when will the deaths be too many? At what point will we be minded to condemn Israel? Will you wait for 5,000 deaths? Will you wait for 10,000, 15,000, 20,000? At what point will you actually say that Israel has gone too far? And all of my pro-Israel callers pretended that there was a number, but of course, when they were pushed to define what that number was, and as we have subsequently discovered, there was not a figure of too many deaths for supporters of Benjamin Netanyahu. So how many deaths in Iran until the West should do something?
Well, already it's too many, but likewise in Palestine...
It's the same answer I got about Israel. So how many deaths in Iran before the West should do something?
But hang on, James. The problem with Palestine is we were active in that genocide.
No, I'm not asking about that. I'm asking how many Iranians have to die before you feel that the West should do something to stop more Iranians from dying.
My heart says do it now.
Yes.
But my mind says you can't.
And I'm asking your mind.
Yeah, we can't.
So I'm asking your mind. So your answer is...
We can't. The Iranian
An unlimited number of deaths. An unlimited number of deaths. We must never intervene.
Unless the Iranian... Yeah,
well,
how can we?
I don't know. I'm just pointing out the... I mean, this is a really unhelpful hosting gig from me today. Is I'm actually pointing out the impossibility of most positions on this, and possibly the inevitability of yours if we were to be dealing, as you point out, in entirely rational and entirely unemotional ways. If you can't explain exactly what you're going to do and how it would work with a guarantee or a likelihood in that 60, 70, 80% region, then you have to be on the side of doing nothing. And yet I can't feel that. In the way that Yasmin just beautifully illustrated the tension between her head and her heart. Mina is in Salisbury. Mina, what would you like to say?
Hi, Isaiah. Good morning. Well, hello. I think the first thing that you can do today is speak about Irfan Soltani that is going to be executed today.
I have done, and I will continue to do so.
Yes, and I think that all news stations should do that because apparently that's the one way to stop them.
I think they are, actually. I mean, you put me in a position where I sound like I'm interrupting everybody, and they are all talking about Irfan Soltani. He's in every single newspaper, and he was on every screen in this studio when I sat down 42 minutes ago. I've mentioned him already, and I think he will be on every screen in this studio again in the course of the day, and please God he doesn't get executed later.
Brilliant, because that's exactly how they stop these things, and it's not the first time that they've done it, and they keep doing it. They've been terrorizing the nation, terrorizing the region, and, you know, I think that the legal path of making them a terrorist organization is the one that definitely should be pursued.
Yes.
And I think that the diplomatic ties with them should be cut.
But this will achieve nothing. America have already made them a terrorist organization, and they're a lot more powerful and influential than we are.
That's just America. I think
they're quite big and important on this stage.
They are very big and important, and I think the West knew exactly what to do in 1979. They can do it again. So, you know, for different reasons this time. And, you know, you can't have 80 million people being held hostage by a terrorist organization.
Well, the West lost in 1979.
Well, did they? Well, the Khomeini came from nowhere in the suburbs of Paris all by himself and became a global known entity
You're tempting me into territory where I'm not supremely confident. But I thought that the monarchy was supported by the United States of America and that the... theocratic republic was not.
Well, it's a whole other debate, but... I'm not fully
confident on this subject, but I'm not sure it is a whole other debate that the Shah's regime was supported by the West and the Ayatollahs was not.
I think the Shah's regime stopped being supported by the West because they stopped listening. Right. And then that was no longer...
Well, any, so we can agree that 1979 doesn't perhaps provide a perfect model for what the West should be doing now, because, as we've just established, it's still confused in both our minds.
Yes, well, what I'm trying to say is that if the West want to do something, they can. We can start by some cyber attacks on their military capabilities. That doesn't have to kill anybody.
We're probably already doing that, aren't we?
I hope so.
So what are we going to put on our banners? What are we going to put on our slogan? I don't mean that in a glib way. What are we actually going to demand of our politicians in really substantive and meaningful ways? Because I think the list is surprisingly short, Mina.
Well, we can start by asking the people on the ground to take pictures of the people who are actually abusing them so they can be held accountable.
Yeah, but they've got no internet access at the moment. So what are they going to do with those pictures?
They're going to keep them until they do.
Until they do. You know, and then they can post them like some Americans are trying to do with ICE protesters.
I think it was already said by Trump. Trump already said, make sure that you know who is doing the attacking so that they will be held accountable. The same way that the money that they're stealing. The problem that we have is that the IRGC hold the money, hold the business. They know how to navigate sanctions. They know how to continue to operate and terrorize the world. And the people of Iran can't do business because of the sanctions, because they don't know how to navigate those sanctions.
My heart is in full agreement with everything that you're saying, but my head is shouting out, well, go on, give me more. Put some detail on the paper. I mean, we proscribe the IRGC. Other countries already have. Render them a terrorist organization like the United States have done. But if the United States... action doesn't touch the sides, then the United Kingdom's is going to be considerably less effective. The problem with corruption, of course, with financial corruption, is that its tentacles end up reaching into every corner of a country and beyond its borders as well. And how much faith can you have in Donald Trump, whose regime is literally in the process of protecting someone who shot an innocent protester in the face and attacking the innocent protester's widow, is the latest news on that front, to do what is right by Iranian people. If I was Iranian, I'd be calling for his help, because I don't know where else help is going to come from. But I'm not. I'm sitting here with an eye on both countries, and I'm saying, be careful what you wish for. And just because your enemy's enemy might look like your friend today doesn't mean they will be tomorrow.
This is LBC.
The following is from TFL.
My name was Luna, like the moon. I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Whatever you're cooking up this year, Lidl has your back. From supporting your protein goal to your plant-powered lifestyle. Enjoy up to 20% off our chilled high-protein and Vomondo plant-based ranges with Lidl Plus. So you can fuel your day your way. Lidl. More to value. 18 plus GB only. While stocks last. Terms apply. See Lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 14/1/26.
Selling your car can be super simple if you choose We Buy Any Car, because they sort out any outstanding finance for you. Just bring along your final settlement agreement. If only they could make parallel parking simpler.
To the right a bit, mate. Yeah, back a bit. Bit more. Oh, no, too far.
We Buy Any Car. Selling made simple. To sell your car today, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Always dreamt of running your own business? It might be easier to achieve than you think. With a franchise, you benefit from a tried and tested business model and ongoing support. Kickstart your journey to business ownership. Visit the British and International Franchise Exhibition on the 30th and 31st of January at Olympia, London. Meet exciting franchise brands, watch inspiring talks, and get free expert advice. Book your free tickets today at franchisetickets.co.uk.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
James O'Brien on LBC.
It is 10:48, and it's, I don't know, I mean, whether it will be reflected in listening figures or anything like that, but the impossibility of sustaining a pungent opinion on this subject is becoming clearer. Should something be done? Yeah, abso-flipping-lutely. Can we stand by and do nothing while the mad mullahs of Iran terrorise their own population? No, something must be done. Are you so desperate to see something being done that you trust Donald Trump to do it? Okay, we can start breaking down on that one. No, not really. I mean, I'd rather trust a bod to lead this campaign than Donald Trump. But we've got no choice. He's currently the leader of the free world. So that's where the first fracture appears in our consensus that something must be done. Who's going to lead it? The Mango Mussolini, who's actually currently defending and lying about the killing of peaceful protesters on American soil? Yeah, not fancy that. But if I was Iranian, I'd probably take it because he's the only player on the table. This is the only card that we can pick up. But what should be done? Dropping bombs on Iran? Would you be in favour of that? Well, yeah, if you could guarantee where they'd land. Not sure that's possible. All right, not bombs, then cyber warfare. Or more sanctions, or proscribe organisations. And this isn't a criticism of anybody. This is simply an illustration, a clarification of reality. A lot of those things have already been tried. If not by us, then by more powerful countries than ours, like the United States of America, who have adjudged the IRGC to be terrorists. And yet they're still in charge. They're still financially rewarding their supporters, and the corruption. So I don't know, that's it. I just think it might be helpful for us to admit to each other that we all think something must be done, but we don't know what. And then you have some understanding of how difficult it is to be a foreign secretary or a prime minister. 10 to 11 is the time, or not. There's plenty of time for you to tell me that I've got my head completely backwards this morning. Simon is in Preston. Simon, what would you like to say?
Oh, morning, James. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome.
I'm very sad to say, unfortunately, I don't think we can get involved. We only have to look back at the West's interference over many, many years, and often our betrayal of those people we're meant to be helping. I'll cite a few little examples. I'm nearly 62, and I remember very clearly when the Americans got blown up in Lebanon and with a huge loss of life to themselves. That was one example of foreign interference which didn't work. But then, obviously, the Iraq war, where we were taken to war on a lie, I was supportive of it because I obviously thought there was some sort of weapons that were going on. And then in the first Iraq war, when the Americans encouraged the Kurds to rise up, and they rose up, and then they turned their backs on them, they were slaughtered in their thousands. You have to look at Cameron's interference with other European countries and the fall of Libya. Don't get me wrong.
There's a difference between wanting to get rid of something awful and being confident you're going to replace it with something better.
Well, I just wanted to mention with the Gaddafi situation, it became a free-for-all, if you remember.
Yeah, of course.
And the beginning of the issues with many illegal immigrants being exploited and taken across
it's
the
hideous.
Mediterranean.
Absolutely
I think started as a consequence of the West turning its back on those on that regime, and well, not the regime, on what happened. You know, we go in there, we blow everything up.
On the country, turning its back on the populations. I mean, this is what Demir said, our Bosnian correspondent, about the, it's a great phrase, the stomach and the stamina for the long-term state building that would be needed to mould fragile states into stable democracies.
The mistakes made with Iraq, if you remember, we went in there, we destroyed everything, we disbanded their army, their weapons got distributed amongst various groups.
But a lot of people keep telling me, I'm doing a lot of interrupting today, which some people are delighted by and some people don't like, but it is to keep the conversation circling back to the central point. And a lot of people are telling us that Iran is so different, the people of Iran are so demonstrably and intrinsically inherently different from the people of Libya or the people of Iraq or the people of Afghanistan, that these parallels don't matter, that somehow stability would be more easily achieved within Iran than it would within any of the other territories that we've talked about. And I am relying upon Iranians for that perspective, and therefore I am loath to challenge it too robustly.
I don't know. I'm not qualified to be able to make an opinion on the Iranian people, but I just think the only thing we've got to go on is our own dreadful, dreadful legacy of what we've done in the past. And I can't, you know, I have no faith at all in Western powers.
But do you know what else I could do? I could do, and I probably haven't got the knowledge to do it as effectively as I might if I did a bit of homework, but I could point out, is everything all right? Did you just drop something?
No, I'm just putting stuff in my dishwasher.
That's quite... Well, this is a... This is a, well, this is a new low for me.
No, nothing personal.
I could make a little... Oh, talk about the shallow end to the deep end and back again. I could... I admire your multitasking. You're a one-man refutation of the misandrist claims about men's inability to do two things at the same time. But I am...
I could... ask my partner that. She'd disagree with you.
Well, here's the proof. I could make a list of what happens when we don't do anything. I think Sudan, probably, off the top of my head, would be an example of that.
Yeah, but the thing is, where we've also made a massive mistake, we've basically tried to impose the Western system
on countries.
On a system.
Yeah, but they had
on a system which was medieval, basically, where one who terrorizes the most is the person in power. And I don't think we can impose, you know, if you think about the history of our country, we only got democracy having gone through a civil war and various other upheavals. It just doesn't happen overnight, unfortunately.
And again, that Iranian perspective would kick in here with the memories of what life was. It was essentially a monarchy. It was quite a Western-facing monarchy as well, as I understand it, that the Shah headed up. And so that's the closest you've got to a counter-argument against, have we learned nothing from that long list of countries in living memory where Western intervention has not exactly gone well. The counter-argument is, oh yes, but Iran is different. And I don't actually remember that argument being made, for example, when people cited Afghanistan as a reason why we shouldn't go into Libya. And remember, Syria is a fascinating piece on this chessboard, because we didn't do what many people called upon the West to do in Syria. I think David Cameron wanted to go in, didn't he? And that Ed Miliband essentially led the vote that prevented him from doing so. Again, forgive me if I've slightly misremembered that. And the case for doing that, for going in Syria, was probably stronger than the original case for going in to Iraq. But the memories were fresh of what had happened in Iraq. And so the case for further Middle Eastern intervention was undermined, was diluted. And I don't know what the state on the ground is in Syria today in comparison with what it was like at the worst moments of Assad's regime. But the general consensus seems to be that from chaos has come stability from within the country, as opposed to from without. So I don't know that we're learning anything here except the possibility of learning anything. And Simon's wonderful ability to multitask. Lawrence is in Maidstone. Lawrence, what made you pick up the phone?
Yeah, I'm Anglo-Persian.
Okay.
I grew up in Iran until the revolution. I actually got evacuated. And I actually got on the news at 10.
Wow.
Yeah, as a 7-year-old.
Gosh.
Anyway, if you want to fix Iran, you don't need Trump.
No.
You don't need any bombs. You don't need soldiers or anything. The Iranian people will deal with it. If you want to solve the problem, get rid of the people at the top. And not by killing them. It's very simple. You offer them one of two things, two choices. They're either going to get hung by the people of Iran, or you offer them safe passage and some money. And you know what? They'll take the safe passage and the money every time.
But we're not there yet, though, are we? We're not, because they've still got largely the whip hand in this scenario. And that the point at which that offer would be irresistible is the point at which the offer doesn't really need to be made at all anyway. The point at which it's die or flee is the point at which they've already lost. So,
you give it to them now. They will, you have to offer it early, and because
they're not going to take it now. You phone up the Ayatollah now and say, all right, you can go and live in Switzerland for the rest of your life with all the money you could possibly do. You think he'd quit? Respectfully, I think that's a bit bonkers, Lawrence.
You've seen every time there's been...
These people hang on until the last imaginable minute, don't they? They have to be dragged out of their palaces by their fingernails, historically. Look at Assad in Syria and the situation that to have reached absolutely irreversible states before they'd hit the road, they'd flee.
Exactly. Look at Syria. Look at Iraq. Look at Libya, right? That's the one thing they don't want to do. They don't want to end up like Gaddafi. They don't want to end up like Saddam.
Gaddafi didn't want to end up like Gaddafi. Saddam didn't want to end up like Saddam. Yeah. But that's my point, is that they did, because the idea of putting an offer on the table when they think they've still got a dog in the race is pie in the sky.
No, yeah, but we've never.
And they walk away. They walk away with impunity. They don't get held to account for what they've done. They're not punished. There's no justice for the thousands of dead and murdered.
I agree. It's abhorrent, but the point is, it's about saving lives. Yeah, you're gonna have to.
No, that's true. That's the ethical form.
There is going to be a lot of blood spilt, because every time a regime gets overturned, it's payback time. Yeah, there will be a lot of blood, right? And the only thing we can do is reduce the amount of blood. And unfortunately, I know it is apparent that in everybody, but if you can get them to just walk away, right? They might not have to go that far. They might have, maybe Afghanistan would take them.
Okay, yeah. It's a thought, I say that largely because it's already gone 11 o'clock and we have to move on, and I don't want to be like, you know, especially given your background, your history, your family's heritage, in any way rude, but I mean, if that comes to fruition, Lawrence, I'll give you the money myself, as the great Les Dennis used to say in slightly different contexts.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the head of West Midlands Police has apologised to MPs for giving them incorrect evidence used to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from a football match at Aston Villa. Craig Guildford has blamed AI after a security report referenced a game between Maccabi and West Ham, which never happened. The Home Secretary is due to make a statement to the Commons later. LBC's Midlands reporter George Ike has more details.
The Home Secretary, who is also a Birmingham MP, Shabana Mahmood, has received a report that she commissioned from the inspectors who look at our police forces across the country as to how that evidence was gathered, and crucially, whether Craig Guildford retains her confidence as the Chief Constable.
Iran's top judge has suggested people held over the anti-regime protests there could be executed. It's despite a warning from Donald Trump that he'll take very strong action if that happens. Sir Starmer is preparing to face MPs in the Commons this lunchtime after U-turning on digital IDs. People now won't be forced to sign up to the scheme to prove their right to work in the UK. Other forms of ID, like biometric passports, will be accepted instead. Speaking to LBC earlier, the Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander pushed back on accusations. It's Labour's 13th U-turn.
I don't accept this characterisation that there's somehow been 30 U-turns that the government have done. I think that's political mischief that other political parties are, you know, seeking to put about. The right to work, the digital right to work check will still be mandatory, and I can assure your listeners of that.
It's emerged councils in England and Wales spent more than £150 million last year on legal battles against parents of children with special needs. Analysis by LBC shows local authorities lost 99% of the Send Tribunal cases. Plans have been revealed to build a new railway line between Birmingham and Manchester, but the government's given no timescale for the project. It'll come after major rail upgrades across the north of England, including east-to-west connections. And 17,000 properties in Kent and Sussex remain without water this morning. South East Water has apologised, saying supply has been restored to around 8,000 homes and works are continuing. It's blamed leaks and burst pipes following the recent cold weather. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 33 at £10,169. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloudy with patchy rain for the southeast, dry and breezy elsewhere, a high of 9 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Four minutes after 11 is the time. I forgot to share with you a bit of a departure on Unhinged Headline yesterday. If you're newish to the programme, Unhinged Headline, all of the regular features on this programme are not regular. I should probably explain this to the ever-growing army of new listeners signing up for the programme. I love, like, regular features, but we lack whatever it is that we need as a team to actually have regular features. We come up with really good ideas, and we do them, but not in any way that could be described as regular. We forget for months on end sometimes, and then one of us will say, we haven't done an Unhinged Headline for a while. Or one of us might say, what happened to Woke Watch? I used to love Woke Watch. Or I'll read a text out to the top team, and it will say something like, I used to really enjoy your missed informations. What happened to those? What else can we put on this list of the ones that we have now forgotten between us? I've got three there. Usually I do quite a routine about having to wait months to get a jingle put together by the production office, who spend 23 hours and 59 minutes working on the newsagents podcast. And then we have to share out the remaining minute between everybody else in the building. By the time I get what Keith likes to rather grandly call production, by the time we get the production, I've forgotten what the production was for. So someone will play me a tape of something going like, Unhinged Headline! And I'll go, what's that all about? What are you talking? You asked for it. I say, when? And they'll say, well, about December 2022, probably. But we finally got around to doing it, because the news agents were on holiday. So that's what regular features are on this programme. They are features, technically, but they're rarely regular. And Unhinged Headlines normally takes the mickey out of the headline writer, or indeed the person who has written the article beneath the headline. It's usually a bloke called Alistair Heath. I mean, it started off being quite varied, and there was quite a little bit of mixture and a bit of competition for who would be the most unhinged. Dan Hannan, you remember him? Sorry for reminding you of his existence. He was a fairly reliable contributor to Unhinged Headline. Daily Mail, obviously, yesterday, ringing around desperately for somebody to defend the Musk platform and its determination to resist and mock people who are disgusted by affording perverts the ability to undress children. Could you write us an article about that? And a million people said no. Finally, they found someone prepared to do it, but it doesn't quite qualify as an unhinged headline because the territory is so grim. But this is an unhinged headline of a very different order. It comes from The Guardian, and it's just something that I felt compelled to share with you.
Unhinged Headline.
Her time has come. Did Mondrian owe his success to a cross-dressing lesbian artist who lived in a Cornish cove? Something about that headline. I don't know if it qualifies as unhinged, but I haven't got a feature that would fit it better. I just thought it was so lovely. It's an example of the meeting, the marriage of unhinged and beautiful. It also sounds like a Sun column from about 1980 when they used to pretend that left-wing politics was dedicated only and exclusively to looking after people who could be characterised by really, really tiny constituent parts. So, they don't care about us, they only care about one-legged Patagonian llama farmers or something like that. Whereas a cross-dressing lesbian artist who lived in a Cornish cove is a very real and very powerful story about a British artist called Marlo Moss. Anyway, you don't care. You just enjoyed the headline. Her time has come. Did Mondrian owe his success to a cross-dressing lesbian artist who lived in a Cornish cove?
Unhinged Headline.
We've actually got an email address So this is what I meant. Eleanor's just remembered. We've got an email address, and our New Year's resolution is to make our irregular features regular on the programme. So if you email unhingedheadline@lbc.co.uk with your nominations for Unhinged Headline, then we might remember to check. And if we remember to check, we might remember to read it out. That's how it works. We might remember to check. And if we remember to check, we might remember to read. We might remember the feature, and then we might remember to check. And if we've remembered the feature and remembered to check, then we might remember to read it out. But I wouldn't hold your breath on any of those three constituent parts that would have to be in place for this to actually happen. And if anyone can remember whether this was the first or the second Unhinged Headline of the year, we'd be very grateful for your input. unhingedheadline@lbc.co.uk. I think it'll be about March 2027 before I read that out and remember to share it with you again. And it has to be brand new, all right? Don't send us ones that have popped up on your social media feed from a million years ago. We've probably already done them, and even if we haven't, it has to be newish. We prefer comment pieces. I give you a little bit of a clue. Just check out the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph. And we never really read the Daily Express, so I bet there's some absolute corkers in there. But, there's only so much I'm prepared to do on your behalf every morning, and opening up the Daily Express is, at the moment, a little bit... It'd be up there with watching GBBs, wouldn't it? Well, they probably also have unhinged headlines, but I got a horrible sense they'd enjoy the attention. Anyway, 10 minutes after 11, what are we going to talk about next? Well, it's easy. Did Mondrian owe his success to a cross-dressing lesbian artist who lived in a Cornish cove? 0345 6060 973. I know I often say I don't know the answer to the questions that I'm asking you, but on this occasion, I really have no idea whether or not Mondrian owes his success to a cross-dressing lesbian artist who lived in a Cornish cove. Hit the numbers now. You will get through. I'll wait. All right, I'm joking. Here's a story that when I tell you that I love a story, you know what I mean now, don't you? It doesn't mean I love the content of the story. I love what it does to my brain. I don't really like... Sometimes, I mean, yesterday, the ADHD phone-in, which I absolutely adore, doesn't involve me doing much work anymore. I just set the story up. I explain why I find it interesting. And adult diagnoses with ADHD sort of queue up to share incredibly important, and I find, and I know you do as well, powerful and moving stories. But the topics that excite me the most of a morning are the ones that take my brain to places that it hasn't been to before, and even, dare I say, make me wonder whether I might have got something wrong in the past because of a story that has provided a new perspective on it in the present. And we very, very much have one of those stories today. Law, in fact, I've taken so long faffing about with cross-dressing lesbian artists that you can ring in to answer this when I've done the one sentence introduction if you want. If you're a medical graduate who trained here, you may find it a particularly easy question to answer. So the question will be, should the law be changed to require that the NHS offers all training jobs to UK doctors, UK-trained doctors, before they offer those jobs to anybody else? The NHS will not be allowed to offer foreign doctors training jobs unless no British ones have applied for the role. Are you for that or against it? 0345 6060 973. So one of the horriblest, is that a word? One of the most unpleasant phrases that I heard as the aftermath of Brexit allowed nativism, xenophobia, and often even racism to reassert itself on our population and particularly on our public discourse. You know, whether or not you were comfortable with that or delighted by it is moot, to be honest. No one's really going to argue that we're living in a country where public discourse has become a lot more racist than it was 10 years ago. Not just on social media, but also in Parliament. Some of the stuff that Honest Bob Jenrick has come out with in recent months would have been a sackable offence under almost any other previous Conservative leader, except probably Liz Truss or Boris Johnson. So the world has changed. And as part of that process of change, phrases were detoxified. And one of the phrases I always struggled with was, we should train our own. I never felt, when I went to the doctors or when I went to A&E, which is the father of young humans, I had to do quite a lot. I never felt any sense of disappointment if I was presented with a nurse or a doctor who seemed likely to have been born somewhere other than the United Kingdom. I used to hear people pretending not to be racist claim that the only thing they were worried about was the accent, but there are plenty of native accents to the British Isles that we find impenetrable. We find each other's accents impenetrable. So that was never really true when people claim they're just worried about the accent. It was usually the skin colour that they were really privately complaining about, and now we live in a country where they can actually complain about the skin colour. They don't have to pretend it's just the accent they're worried about. They can share their disgust or their shock or their, what was it, their madness at seeing brown and black faces in television adverts without facing any censure from their own employers in Nigel Farage's party. So one imagines they'd be perfectly entitled to say the same thing about hospital wards or A&Es. So that phrase, we should train our own, always, always, always troubled me because of two things. The message that it sent out to the doctors and nurses who do look after us all, regardless of where we're from and where they're from, that they were somehow second best. I am French. I am a doctor. I am listening to a radio presenter say that I wish you weren't here doing your job. I am Indian. I am a doctor. I am listening. I am reading a newspaper article that is coming perilously close to saying, I wish you'd never come here. But the question I've got for you today is whether or not this proposal is different, because it feels very different to me. And I am worried, and I've been worried for some time, but I don't know that I've shared this with you. I'm worried about the Overton window, which has shifted so far to the right now, as we know, the lesson of the Overton window is that everybody shifts with it. Even people who are passionately anti-racist can only conduct conversations within the parameters of the Overton window, so everybody becomes more right-wing as a consequence of public discourse becoming more right-wing. To be part of public discourse, you have to fit through the window. Do you see what I mean? And I've been worried about it in theory. I haven't been worried about it in any way in practice, but I've been worried that I might need to soon. In other words, that, you know, as the discourse changes and we take our lead from public discourse every morning, we're going to end up saying things or contemplating or considering things that we would have found inconceivable 5, 10, 15 years ago. And I just worried this morning that this might be one of them, because I am in favour of this. Until you tell me why I shouldn't be. I am in favour of this, and I do not feel that it would in any way make a foreign-born doctor in this country feel second best. But I can only hold that thought until you tell me that I'm right or that I'm wrong as a foreign-born doctor. It adds to a sense of nativism in our political rhetoric, but does it actually add substance to nativism? Does it actually add substance to some sort of hierarchy of ethnicity or geographical origin? My initial position would be that we want every single medical position in this country to be filled by the person most qualified, by the best person for the job. But if we also live in a country where the taxpayer is funding medical training, and trained medics are currently facing under and unemployment, then I can see, until you tell me why I shouldn't, I can see a very strong case for arguing simply that the NHS will not be allowed to offer foreign doctors training jobs unless no British ones have applied for the role under legislation being fast-tracked through Parliament. And the reason I worry about the Overton window is that this means today that I find myself saying that two people of equal validity or equal relevance to the question being asked should be treated differently according to where they, well, I'm going to say where they trained, but you could say where they came from, and I would currently struggle, but I think I'd ultimately succeed, but I would currently struggle a bit to properly highlight the importance of that distinction. It's not where you came from, it's where you trained. It's UK-trained doctors. The NHS will not be allowed to offer foreign doctors training jobs unless no British ones have applied for the role. Medical graduates currently need to complete 2 foundation years in the NHS before applying for a training post in a specialty such as surgery or anaesthesia. That's the first step towards becoming a consultant. Foreign graduates since 2020 have been able to apply for these jobs on the same terms as British graduates. This has increased competition. It's only been in place since 2020. Who was in power in 2020? Was it Theresa May or Boris? It was Boris Johnson, wasn't it? And it means that 40,000 doctors applied for 12,000 training roles and only 37% were UK graduates. So 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. And again, as with Iran, this may well be an area where your grasp of the finer detail is even more valuable than usual. But I don't have a grasp of the finer detail beyond the fact that I welcome the idea that the people we've paid to train should get first dibs on becoming the people who then treat us. You see what I mean about this being a tricky one, though? Because how close am I now to saying we should train our own and making a foreign-born doctor feel unwelcome or unwanted or unvalued? Can I have my head and have my cake and eat it here? 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need. Should the law, simple question but complex answers, should the law require the NHS to offer all training jobs to UK doctors before offering any to foreign doctors? So you cannot apply for one unless no British trained ones have applied for the role. Hit the numbers now. You will get through, okay? 0345 6060 973. I don't think it happens anywhere else. I don't think anybody, when they're looking to replace me on LBC, is going to care unduly or say that we can't hire an Australian unless no British people apply for the job. I can't think of many other roles, many academic roles. I mean, I've been going to church a bit recently, and every Catholic priest I've encountered in the last 6 months appears to be, or certainly sounds as if they are foreign-born. Are we offering priests the same sort of thing? But we're paying for the training of the doctors, and therefore it seems, I don't know, you tell me. I told you it was tricky, and I don't fully know what I think, but I think I like it. 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need. It's 1121.
This is LBC.
Always dreamt of running your own business. It might be easier to achieve than you think. With a franchise, you benefit from a tried and tested business model and ongoing support. Kickstart your journey to business ownership. Visit the British and International Franchise Exhibition on the 30th and 31st of January at Olympia, London. Meet exciting franchise brands, watch inspiring talks, and get free expert advice. Book your free tickets today at franchisetickets.co.uk.
At Ocado, you'll save 25% on your first shop and get free delivery. Which means if you were to buy a 4-cheese pizza, you'd basically be getting one of the cheeses for free. Save and splurge at Ocado, the online supermarket. Geographical and other restrictions. Minimum spend £60 and charges apply. New customers only. Maximum saving £20. Terms at ocado.com.
You want £1 million.
I'd love £1 million.
So you enter the birthday draw. It's a very personal draw, so you think of a personal way to spend £1 million.
I would hire a hype man, so everything I do would suddenly be epic.
It's a lucky day, and you win the birthday draw, so...
Let's go, Kev! Goat cheese bagel for lunch!
Woohoo! This could get tiresome.
Is it your lucky day? Search the birthday draw and enter now. From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only. No purchase necessary.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
22 minutes after 11 is the time. I mean, I can highlight the difficulties of this conversation even further by pointing out that it has apparently only really been the case since 2020. So why was it changed? You'd have thought post-Brexit, a policy that meant we could treat foreigners worse than British graduates would have been anathema to whatever government was in charge. But since 2020, foreign graduates, so this is about people who have done their degrees either at British universities, presumably Irish universities as well, or foreign universities, being treated differently. Since 2020, they've been treated exactly the same. I don't know why that rule was changed, actually. I don't know why that legislation was passed. But I do know that you've now got about 40,000 doctors applying for about 12,000 roles, and only 37% were UK graduates. So you could fill all 12,000, really, without having to cast your net any further. Is that something we should welcome? I think it is, but I'm really uncomfortable with the proximity of this position in my mind to the idea that we should train our own, and the message that that sends to people who are dedicated to doctoring, regardless of what the words on their passport might say. Hillary's in Derby. Hillary, what would you like to say?
Oh, yes, hi.
Hello.
I understand the issue that they've got with lacking of number of places, and actually we are training our own. That's exactly yes. what we have done. So I don't really get... It's a really difficult one, isn't it? We are affected by this as a family. My daughter's partner is coming to the end of his second year, and he did a telephone interview. He's got a job immediately in New Zealand for next year, immediately. And a lot of the problem with the doctor strikes that they're having at the moment is being misrepresented in the press, because they're being labelled as leaving the NHS in droves, as if it's a really bad thing and it's all their fault. And actually, they're leaving because there aren't the positions here for them to do.
Well, we have so accurately reflected that reality on this programme, Hillary.
Indeed. I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you. And it's an excellent show, by the way.
Thank you.
I too struggle with the sort of the foreign and the this and the that, and
it just seems weird that that people who don't necessarily want to leave the UK, who did their degree here, are leaving the UK, while people who didn't do their degree here are getting.
Yeah.
If it is that simple, then it's a funny one, isn't it?
Well, he is in a position where they have a mortgage.
Yeah.
He's in a position where he has to go abroad to earn or do bank work, which costs a lot and isn't reliable. So if they stop doing the bloody bank work and just put the money into another place for somebody to have a job, it would be better. But additionally, it's the impact on the family, because my daughter is looking at going abroad with him. So she works in engineering, right. So we're going to lose her as well. We as a family are going to lose them to abroad, and it may be only temporary, but who knows what will happen after that.
Well, I mean, precisely that. Do we understand why it changed in 2020? Do we understand why this situation came about in the first place?
Well, didn't they try and invest in training people? They tried to train a load of people. And so what's happened is they've done a really good job of creating loads and loads of new doctors, which is just what we need, so that we have people to fill the NHS places. The trouble is, but now they're coming to that point, and they haven't invested the money, from what I can see, in actually putting enough places in place for those newly qualified doctors. And so, I can understand.
It's hard to sell that. I can as well. And as you've reminded us, it's a key demand of the BMA, of the junior doctors who've been on strike for 59 days. So if the idea that this is a successful industrial action should quell some left-wing concerns, some left-wing conniptions about the proximity it apparently has to the rhetoric of nativism. I just need to understand better how we've ended up spending £4 billion training medics every year while simultaneously leaving many of them feeling as if they can't get the kind of job that they want, while somebody that we haven't paid to train is... I mean, do we know whether or not we would be compromising the principle of the best possible person getting the contract by doing this?
I have that worry too, but I then fall back on, well, they must be appropriate because they wouldn't have passed their qualifications. So, they're either good enough to be a doctor or they're not. They're not necessarily going to be an absolute mega specialist, but they're going to be, you know, if they're not competent, there's something wrong with the training, isn't there?
Yes, but I mean, there's competent. Competent is a bar over which 100 people could get, but there would still be 100 different calibers of quality, or 100 different qualities of those doctors. Thank you. And I mean, that's a perfect example of it. Somebody who is ready and waiting to take up a training post within the NHS is not going to, because it is so hard to do. I'm going to tell you exactly what Wes Streeting said, because I, much as I love the sort of philosophy of this question, the detail is obviously crucial. Phone lines are open. British taxpayers spend £4 billion training medics every year, so it makes little sense for many of them to be left struggling to get speciality training places and fearing for their futures. Spoke to loads of those doctors during the last round of industrial action. The catastrophic mismanagement of the system by the previous administration has left UK graduates competing with doctors from around the world, with applicants rising from 12,000 in 2019. And remember, there are currently 12,000 training roles. Go back 6 years, there were 12,000 applicants. Result happiness to nearly 40,000 this year. So the question is twofold. The question is, Do we welcome this? To which I think the answer is yes. But I also really want to know how we've ended up in this situation. I tried to get to the bottom of this during the last round of BMA industrial action, and I didn't. Did you have the same problem, or was I just being a bit slow on the uptake? I was sort of thinking, how has this come about? If you go back to 2019, when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, you had 12,000 applicants for roles that currently number 12,000. There were probably fewer roles back then. They changed the rules. Did they change the rules because they thought that this was the only way to get more doctors, to hire more doctors? How have you created a scenario where we're spending £4 billion training medics who can't get the training places that they want, and simultaneously watch doctors who have done their degree overseas slide in front of them in the selection process? Again, I don't know. Does that simply mean that the foreign doctor is a better bet than the British-trained doctor? Because if that's the case, then we've got a whole heap of other problems. You can see why I called this tricky. If you think you can help unravel some of these knots, the number you need, as always, is 0345 6060973. And remember, you're also welcome to call me on the question of whether or not Mondrian does owe his success to a cross-dressing lesbian artist who lived in a Cornish cove. Here's Dominic Ellis with your headlines.
The head of West Midlands Police has apologised for giving MPs false information over the decision to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from a match at Aston Villa last year. Craig Guildford says there was no intention to mislead about a security threat and has blamed AI. Iran's top judge has signalled there'll be fast trials and executions for anti-government protesters. That's despite Donald Trump's warning that he'll take very strong action if executions take place. And Keir Starmer is preparing to face MPs in the Commons this lunchtime after U-turning on digital IDs. Separately, the Chancellor has confirmed that pubs will receive more temporary support on business rates. LBC weather, cloudy with patchy rain for the southeast, dry and breezy elsewhere, a high of 9 degrees.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Hi, I'm Claire, and last year I did my first big hike for Cancer Research UK. It was amazing. The scenery was stunning, the volunteers cheered us through it, and the free hot meal at the end was really what I needed. I did the full marathon hike. There's also a half marathon and a 10K if you don't fancy the big one.
Join thousands of hikers like Claire and escape to nature as you help to fund life-saving research. Search Big Hike today for 30% off your entry. Together, we are beating cancer. T's and C's apply.
At Ocado, you'll save 25% on your first shop and get free delivery. Which means if you were to buy a four-cheese pizza, you'd basically be getting one of the cheeses for free. Save and splurge at Ocado, the online supermarket. Geographical and other restrictions. Minimum spend £60 and charges apply. New customers only. Maximum saving £20 terms at Ocado.com.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. Holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900. That's ADVICE to 78900.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It is 11:33. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. So I told you this was tricky, and I wasn't exaggerating. Here's another little tiddlywink to flick into the pot. Why would anybody? Why would NHS? Why would a foreign trained doctor, a foreign medical graduate, get a job ahead of a British medical graduate? Now, if the answer to that question is because they're cheaper or some obvious and simplistic thing, then things do not get more complicated. But if the answer to that question is because we go through a full and frank we go through a full interview process and we hire the person that we think suits our needs best at the end of it. In which case, suggesting that they shouldn't get the gig and it should go instead to the person who was British trained but came third or fourth in the interview process, that assumes a rather different complexion, right? Well, it does for me, at least. Victoria is in Nottingham. Victoria, what would you like to say?
Hi.
Hello.
I am a... hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah. I think there's a delay on the line. We'll have to sort that out. Why does that happen? I'm just going to have a quick chat with Keith. You talk among yourselves for a minute. Do we know why that happens? Why does someone go from not being on delay when they talk to the producer to being on delay when they come through to me? Little bit of a glitch. It could be a little glitch with the signal. I don't know. That's our technical input on today's program. I don't know. I mean, I don't know either. Louise is in Luton. Louise, what made you pick up the phone?
I'm currently a resident doctor applying for specialty training at the moment.
Boom.
So I thought it was quite...
Right on the money.
You know,
yes.
Yeah. But I think I just wanted to say, I feel like the policy tends to shine a light on the main issue at hand, which is the fact that we just don't have enough specialty training positions. So we're having to get to this point of talking about prioritising UK medical graduates over overseas graduates,
yes,
which maybe is something we should have thought about a while back, because a lot of countries already do it. But I wouldn't necessarily say that that's the main issue at hand. I feel like we need more training spaces, and that is the crux of the matter.
Well, I yes and no. Give me the confidence of a radio presenter arguing with somebody about the thing that is literally their life and their livelihood. It's pathetic, really, but you're used to it by now. There were 12,000 training roles in 2019. And last year there were 12,000 applications. Last year there were 12,000 roles. If you married those two statistics together, you have an almost perfect situation where everybody who wants a role gets one, and there's enough roles for everybody who wants one. Do we know why they, and we use the word we, you did, but it was actually they, why they in 2019 did the thing, or in 2020, that Streeting and the current government now want to undo? Do we know why they opened up the application process to foreign graduates on the same criteria as British graduates?
I don't know if it's just because of service provision, to be honest with you, and trying to ensure that we have enough people that can meet the demand that the NHS is going through at the moment.
Right.
I feel like a lot of us, we come into this job thinking that, you know, we're going to get training and things like that. So I've just finished foundation training. Well, I'm still in my foundation training.
Okay.
And I can't say that the quality of training in terms of giving me the skills that I need overall has met that requirement. We're more focused on service provision. We're more focused on, getting the job done, essentially, when
right.
it's actually meant to be a training role.
Okay, so I think I understand. And is that an answer to the next question I'm going to ask you, which is, when you apply for your training roles and you fail to get one, and somebody who did their training in Australia or France or America gets it, why have they beaten you to that role?
It's interesting. I think a lot of people who have come overseas, I guess I'm generalising.
Yes, of course, I think we have
to. I don't know exactly.
I think we have to, don't worry.
But I think a lot of people are further on in their medical career than we are. So I'm 2 years out of medical school right now. Have I had the same level of opportunity to get all of the papers and publications, audits that I need to move on to the next step? And these are all the kind of, I guess, putting it simply, are hoops that we need to go through to get to the next stage. I'm sure people who run the application process will understand the importance of doing these things. But for me as an applicant, it almost feels like I'm having to do tick box exercises to try and get through to the next stage. I feel like a lot of doctors who already have that experience, if that makes sense, out of training, have the time to do that.
So in a sense, so you are telling us that the NHS Trust is hiring somebody better qualified.
I guess I'm not sure about the actual relationship to it being more qualified or more competent. Because
I understand. I understand. So if I was asking the interviewer, why did you give the job to her and not to Louise? What would they say? They'd say because we thought that was a better candidate.
Yeah, they probably
even though they're foreign.
But I think it's difficult because I'm 2 years out. You know, we're all 2 years out, and I don't want to say I want to compete with or prevent someone else.
But I've paid for your training. Well, I haven't paid for your training. The British taxpayer has paid for your training, and therefore there seems to me to be something quite irresistible about the idea that therefore the British Health Service should prioritise you when filling positions, because it is a return upon our investment as a society or as an economy. I mean, it might be that I'm missing some point here, but at the moment, I think I'm with you. It is 11:40, although getting a couple of messages saying things like, it sounds like a policy to please the racists. That was my worry. But it's also a policy that meets one of the key demands of the BMA's junior doctors who've been on strike, I think, for 50 or 60 days, 59 days since 2023, including those 5 days over the Christmas that's just passed. So, I mean, it's possible that both things are true. It will delight the junior doctors who've been on strike and the racists. But it's up to you which one of those two you think the government is motivated by. Victoria's in Nottingham. Victoria, what would you like to say?
Hi, I am a psychiatrist in Nottinghamshire. And I've just been listening to what you've been saying. And I think one important thing to be really clear about is that junior doctors want training places. They don't want international medical graduates to not have jobs or not be given training. It's just that they want to be able to have training places.
Yeah.
And I do agree with you that this is the government's way of painting the issue of no training places as, inverted commas, those foreigners' fault. And I don't like the use of the word foreigner.
Nor do I.
No, I prefer to say international medical graduates. That's okay. That's the better term. So going forward, I think you have to look at this not just as a snapshot either, as, you know, more of a longer journey from years back, in the sense that staffing the NHS and adequately planning for a medical workforce has been inadequately done for many, many years.
Mm.
And therefore, people, instead of using strategic decisions, they've made very quick decisions about trying to fill rota gaps of medics. And therefore, what they've done is they've opened up schemes to try and bring international medical graduates to fill those gaps. And consequently, what they've done is they've offered them the most rubbish of the medical jobs that involve no training, no support, literally just finishing, you know, filling these service gaps. You might be familiar with the term locally employed doctor.
Yeah.
Basically, what that means is that a trust can employ a doctor under whatever salary they like, give them no training and support outside fulfilling clinical duties, and therefore they do just plug that gap. So they've employed lots and lots of international medical graduates who really are some of the ones that are more willing to fill these gaps because they want to come to the UK. They've heard how good the training schemes are. And then the international medical graduates have aspirations, as
of
many
course.
Doctors do.
Yes.
You know, being a doctor is a career. And they've heard that the British training system is very, very good. So they've applied for that. So actually, this problem has been created by the government itself. And now it's been painted as the fault of international medical graduates.
Well, that might be my fault. That might be the way I've presented it today, because the current government would have no problem at all, and indeed Wes Streeting has gone all in on blaming it on previous governments. This is prior to 2020, the mess that you're describing, inherited by the current government, who are now seeking to undo it, albeit, in your view, I sense, imperfectly.
See, I would disagree
with which bit?
I think it's much, much easier for a government to say, look, let's prioritise our UK medical graduates and not correct the problem that we created ourselves many years ago. You know, you need to own that problem.
No, but I'm just pointing out it's a completely different government.
Yeah. But they're perpetuating those kind of racist views, aren't they?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I don't currently, and I've understood most of what you've said, and I'm certainly going to take on board what you said about international medical graduates or graduates with British citizenships or people who've worked in the NHS for a significant period will also get priority for training posts under this bill, as I'm sure you know, but mm-hmm. I should probably explain sooner. Just in something about the relationship between training, country and job doesn't stick in my craw in the way that I expected it would, to simply say we're going to try to fill these posts with people who trained here, with people who graduated here first, before we cast our net a little bit wider.
This is another thing as well about the training system in the UK, and it's a very, very old traditional system where, as sure. your previous caller mentioned before, she's a foundation year doctor and she feels as if she's jumping through hoops. And do these things actually add up to better patient care? And who actually sets the bar? Who actually sets the height of these hoops for us to jump through?
Are you letting the perfect be the enemy of the good? Or the perfect be the enemy of the better?
I don't think it's perfect. I think
that's what I mean. I don't think you're pursuing perfection and therefore perhaps not valuing improvement to what is currently going on because they don't go far enough.
I think improvements to what's going on at the moment would be to recognise those doctors who aren't in training at the moment, of which there are many, many. What we do know is that the GMC's workforce report says that locally employed doctors and SAS doctors, who are doctors not in a training scheme and not a consultant, make an increasing proportion of doctors. And those doctors' experience needs to be recognised outside of training schemes. And basically it means that training schemes aren't really fit for purpose.
Okay. But no one yet is really talking about rewiring or dismantling and rebuilding the entire system.
Actually. There is a medical training review.
Well, then you preempted my final question, which is why are the BMA agitating for what you don't think is a good thing?
I think,
or campaigning, not really, agitating.
You can't really say BMA. What you're looking at is you're looking at the Residents Doctors Committee within the BMA.
Well, no, the strike mandate for 59 days since 2023 comes from the membership, not from the committee.
It does, but the resident doctor membership. So nobody was asked about this that wasn't a resident doctor. So this is purely the resident doctors.
But this is what they want.
And needs. Yes. And what they're wanting is they're wanting more training places, aren't they?
Yes. And also they're wanting international medical graduates to be the second port of call rather than the first equal.
I think...
So why? Why are they doing that is what I'm asking you. You may not know. I mean, I'm curious.
I think it's frustration with the training scheme and the fact that there's no training spaces. I think you need to thoroughly understand the workforce, the medical workforce and the training scheme and the initiatives for that to be able to...
Okay.
So why are the BMA doing that?
I want to end with an entirely inappropriate question. Would you mind?
Go for it.
I've always wanted to ask a psychiatrist this question. It's not the obvious one that you're thinking of. I know quite a few doctors, but I don't know any psychiatrists either in my personal or my professional life. And I know that a lot of the other doctors I know are often irritated, as I am, over the Christmas period by people who want to, like, have a political debate or people who think that I'm interested in it. Because I'm like, I'm not at work now. Seriously, I'd much rather talk about the football or how you create your Christmas pudding. Do psychiatrists ever get members of the public after a kind of a cheeky diagnosis or a little bit of sly advice?
Yeah, we're often asked about individuals personally and also individuals in the news to pass comment on individuals in the news, which obviously we're not allowed to under new kind of guidance.
Do you always successfully resist that temptation, Victoria? Because I've got a list.
There's saying things diplomatically, isn't there? And I suppose it's, what do you want to do in that situation if you wanted to to be friends with a person or not? And
exactly that. We will do it. We will take that on board. Thank you so much, and thank you for your very, very helpful guide to the complications of an issue that I already found quite complicated enough. Thank you very much. Before you made everything more complicated.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The chief constable of West Midlands Police, the one caught up in that row over misleading MPs over the use of AI. Be in no doubt, the decision by West Midlands Force to ban the fans from that team, that Maccabi Tel Aviv team, showed how the hardline elements in the Muslim community were able to drown out the concerns of Jewish people in that area. I have to tell you, my friends, anti-Semitism is alive and very well currently in this country, and precious few are doing much about it. And coming back to that copper, I'm not suggesting he's an anti-Semite, by the way. I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting he's just not up to it. He deceived Parliament. He's delusional to think that he can stay in his job.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
At Ocado, you'll save 25% on your first shop and get free delivery. Which means if you were to buy a four-cheese pizza, you'd basically be getting one of the cheeses for free. Save and splurge at Ocado, the online supermarket. Geographical and other restrictions. Minimum spend £60 and charges apply. New customers only. Maximum saving £20. Terms at ocado.com.
Another early morning gym session skipped. Some New Year's resolutions set you up to fail. But a new Mazda CX-30 is the one you will want to keep. Available with 0% APR and a £750 deposit contribution during the Mazda January sale. Order by the 31st of January. Search Mazda. Available on PCP when financed by Mazda Financial Services by the 31st of March 26. Indemnities may be required. Terms apply. Participate in dealers. See website.
Always dreamt of running your own business. It might be easier to achieve than you think. With a franchise, you benefit from a tried and tested business model and ongoing support. Kickstart your journey to business ownership. Visit the British and International Franchise Exhibition on the 30th and 31st of January at Olympia, London. Meet exciting franchise brands, watch inspiring talks, and get free expert advice. Book your free tickets today at franchisetickets.co.uk.
Live and love to the last breath. This January, fall in love with the passion, drama, and heartbreak of the iconic opera that inspired Pretty Woman and Moulin Rouge. Experience the Royal Opera's grand production of La Traviata from the 8th of January to the 17th of February at the Royal Opera House. Get great seats from just £23. Don't miss La Traviata. Book now at rbo.org.uk.
James O'Brien on LBC.
It is 11:51, and it is a policy or an idea that doesn't fit neatly into any particular political pigeonhole, does it? The law will change to require the NHS to offer training jobs to UK graduates before it offers any training jobs to international medical graduates. In fact, the NHS will not be allowed to offer international medical graduates training jobs unless no British ones have applied for the role. Victoria was right, wasn't she? It does somehow feel differently when you replace the word foreigner, which the Times elected to use in its opening line today, with the words international medical graduates, which this article in the Times introduced over halfway through the article. It feels different to me, at least, but maybe that's a me problem rather than an article problem. 11:52 is the time. Why are you comfortable with this when you would be uncomfortable with so many other suggestions that seem to be fileable under we should be training our own and therefore making foreign doctors, foreign-born doctors, not international medical graduates, talking about two different things, feel unwelcome or unvalued. Hassan is in Liverpool. Hassan, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. I am
a doctor. I've been a resident doctor for 5 years now.
Okay.
I've had experience working in Australia, but also the NHS after I graduated. The reason I'm calling is because I'm in the process of, well, I say in the process, I've been rejected from my medical training application this year. And I want to try and put this as simply as I can.
Yeah.
I've been a doctor for 5 years, so I'm fully qualified, fully trained to do the job. Now, anybody else in my position who has presented a poster, a medical poster at an international conference,
yes,
done a PhD, has a first author publication, has taught students for 3 months, and has written chapters in a medical textbook, if you tick all of those boxes and are in my position, you still would not have got an interview for medical training this year.
Why not?
Because
who's getting the interviews?
People with all of that and more.
Wow.
So it's not only about if you're a good doctor anymore. It's not only about if you've been a doctor for 5 years and were trained in the NHS. It's about if you've been a doctor and have won a Nobel Peace Prize and a PhD and everything else. And a few of your previous callers have mentioned it as well, and you've touched on it, as to whether or not that correlates to somebody being a good doctor. And actually, my opinion is no.
But there's two things going on here. I'm more confused. I hate it when this happens. It's almost always my fault. I'm going to be more confused at the end of this than I was at the beginning, because on the one hand, we've got the suggestion that international medical graduates are coming in to plug holes in the system, in the rota system, that that some British graduates may not particularly want to plug. And then you've got us saying that because of the other things that are on offer to international medical graduates in other countries that they can get in the United Kingdom that they can't perhaps get in their own country or elsewhere, in terms of other elements of lifestyle and not necessarily livelihood, they're coming here and pushing people like you into the background. So you've almost got people above you on the scale and people below you on the scale creating the difficulty you have getting the contract that you want.
Yeah, I mean
does that sound right? Did that make sense? It didn't make perfect sense to me. Did you understand what I just said?
I do understand what you're saying.
It's because you're a doctor.
I do understand what you're saying, but look, the way I see it is, so I applied for a job while I'm not in a training position. I still need to find some sort of employment, and that can be in the form of locum work or it can be in the form of just an out of training position. So a couple of months back, I applied for an out of training position as just a general doctor in a department in a hospital.
Yes,
and 48 hours after that application, I got an email from the hospital saying, our sincerest apologies, we've had to close the applications early because in 48 hours, they received 1,000 applications for one job.
Wow.
Now, to me, that doesn't call out that there needs to be gaps being plugged. We're not desperate for international medical graduates to come and save the NHS from an employment.
But were we in 2020?
I graduated in 2021, so I'm not able to.
Because this is the bit. This is the bit that I keep circling back to. Is why did they do it? Do you think it could be Brexit?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that would tie in.
Well, because under the EU rules, you treat British and European applicants the same.
Yeah. Okay.
And then they changed that. And no European, well, they didn't change that particularly, but a huge number of European people didn't want to come here anymore.
Mm.
And they had to then change the system so that you could come here from anywhere and join the NHS because they were worried, whether or not they were right to be worried or not, I don't know, but they were worried about hemorrhaging applications from European graduates. And therefore they smashed this window open and have been taken by surprise by how many people have come through it. Does that make sense on paper?
Yeah, I guess it makes sense on paper, but I think more likely what's happened is that they've gone, they've done what they said they would do and create more medical school training positions.
Yes.
More and more medical schools are popping up, private medical schools, public medical schools, more spaces are being created at current medical schools, but actually they've gone and done that, which is great, you're graduating more doctors.
But they haven't increased the number of training posts.
Yeah, they have nowhere to go, and actually for the first time as far as I'm aware, we're actually seeing doctors who are graduating from medical school, finishing medical school, and they're not guaranteed a foundation training job, which is crazy to me. Like, I mean,
so this is a step in the right direction, but it's by no means the end of the journey.
Yeah, I think so. I'm honestly, I think it's a good thing. I think that prioritising UK graduates for jobs in the UK when taxpayers are contributing towards our training is a completely fair thing to do.
I don't think we need to have the same rhetoric. The problem with 2020 and 2019 is that the country was being governed by absolute anarchists. And so we need to fully understand why this happened in 2020. And I've had a proper look around and could it be COVID related? That seems unlikely. But what they are seeking to undo can only really be judged when we fully understand what was done. That now needs to be undone. But thank you, Hassan. Sometimes I end an hour a little bit more confused than I was at the beginning. And it's not always a sign that I've done my job badly. Sometimes it's a sign that I was right to point out the complexity of the issue that was under discussion. And I hope that this is one of those hours. I just don't quite see the path down which we've gone. I mean, I keep often pointing out to you, in 2010, patient satisfaction in this country, in the NHS, was the highest it had ever been. And obviously that graph just plummets ever downwards throughout the 14 years of Conservative rule. But this milestone on that graph, this odd reversal, where you've gone from having 12,000 applicants in 2019... to having 40,000 applicants this year for 12,000 posts, which just doesn't seem to me to make sense on any level. We will be returning to this territory, but not today, because it is Wednesday, which means PMQs is on the way. And after that, we will be returning to that fascinating journalism being done on The Observer regarding the best-selling, the mega-selling memoirs, The Salt Path. That story just gets, as Alice in Wonderland would have said, curiouser and curiouser. And then Simon Marks will be joining us for reasons that I'm sure I don't need to explain to you, but I will anyway, to bring us up to speed with developments in the United States, in the White House, and the broader ramifications thereof. But before all of that, Natasha Clark is here to tee up PMQs. I just had a really strange thought then. I've never had this thought before, and I'm possibly a little bit reluctant to share it with you.
Come on. I'm interested now. You've piqued my interest.
Well, that's...
And everybody else's.
That's right. I'm thinking about Iran, and I'm thinking about Donald Trump, and I'm thinking the leader of the opposition is about to ask questions of the British Prime Minister, and I did just find myself thinking then, does any of it matter?
I don't know if she's going to go on Iran, you know.
No.
I wonder if she might go on the Maccabi Tel Aviv row, which we've seen explode this morning.
Does the government have any agency in that? Can any of it be pinned on them?
No, not in that
all
way.
All AI's fault,
it's,
apparently.
Well, this was something that... True. This is something... It's all AI's fault. This is something that Prime Minister lent very heavily into last year.
Right.
He tried to pressure the police to let the fans go to this football match. That pressure didn't go anywhere in the end. And Shabana Mahmood actually doesn't have the power to do anything with this police chief who is today admitted misleading MPs.
I didn't think so.
So it's the PCC that does have the power to...
Is it a Labour PCC?
It's a Labour PCC. And he's actually been very much of the opinion that this has all been stirred up in Westminster.
Yeah.
You could see Kemi Badenoch talking about that. You could also see her talking about the digital ID. I think it's fair to say it's been a bit of a mess.
It's
definitely a climb down. Yeah. Is it the 13th U-turn as is being labelled today? Potentially not, but it's very chaotic. And, you know, this is the Prime Minister ripping up his own policies that he only announced 5 months ago.
Which is fascinating on this, even against the backdrop of the other U-turns. And I saw an old Keir Starmer tweet this morning, him attacking, I think, David Cameron's government for U-turns. Would it be done? It couldn't have been done. Anyway, attacking a previous Conservative administration for U-turns and saying there comes a point where it's not listening to the people, it's just evidence of incompetence.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he'd still subscribe to that school of thought today. But this was a popular policy until he introduced it. And then it became incredibly unpopular, and so now he's unintroduced it. I mean, it's not a good look, is it?
It's not, and I do think it sort of just leads to this sense of this government just lacking a direction, and it just adds to weakness about the Prime Minister that he really just needs to get a grip on. There is obviously strength in U-turns when you have to, and when you have to basically say this isn't popular, this isn't the right thing to do. There is strength in a Prime Minister that can do that, but it doesn't feel like this is a Prime Minister that's coming from a place of strength on this right now. And actually, Wes Streeting, I think, summed it up best yesterday. Did you hear that clip from him?
Yeah.
And he said, we need to get it right first time, and, you know, the public won't forgive this government if they continue to be rolling out policy and then rolling it back just a few months later.
Anything else?
I mean, obviously, Iran, you'd expect to be touched upon.
Well, do you know?
I know it's so important. I don't imagine these.
But what are the key issues facing British people today that the leader of the opposition might hit? Because that's what I meant by when I said, does any of it matter? None of the things that we seem to have been talking about are of enormous relevance in terms of the daily life of British people.
And Keir Starmer will, I'm sure, want to talk about the cost of living.
Right.
And that's an argument that of why he's left this digital ID thing to completely change, because he believes that there needs to be a greater focus on the cost of living. And we understand that he's expected to speak on that later this week as well. And that's, you know, should that really be the number one priority of this government? So I imagine that will come up in that respect. Ed Davey has been talking about the NHS this week. I was at a press conference with him yesterday where he was announcing new NHS policy. He wants to basically stop the UK government from paying more to Donald Trump's America for pharmaceutical products and use that money to help end A&E 12-hour waits and corridor care. So I'm sure he'll mention that probably this week. Will he also mention Donald Trump and Iran and potentially military intervention? It's something that feels so serious that some politician should bring it up. But you are right. It's probably not at the forefront of most voters' minds, for sure.
Can I make a suggestion? I think she might bring up the social media ban on under-16s and claim that they're copying her, without mentioning, of course, the fact that Australia have already done it and that the members of the Labour cabinet have been talking about
That'd
it.
That'd be highly disingenuous for her to do
That is how she rolls.
Yeah.
So that would be
only changed her policy 2 days ago.
Yes, that would be my left field position. Mm. That once again, the Prime Minister is stealing my homework or
they've not announced it yet, so I feel potentially they're not quite there.
All right, we'll see.
No,
you're all right. I'll give you that.
But did you see the report in The Guardian today that they're going to... Jonathan Haidt...
I don't read that, right?
You do. I know you love The Guardian. Jonathan Haidt, the author of The Angst Generation, is being put to speak to officials about the perils of social media for under 16s. I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, a divisive figure. More on that later. Here is PMQ.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And can I agree with the Prime Minister's comments on Iran? Today, Irfan Soltani faces execution for protesting in Iran. And I'm sure the whole House will be united in condemning this. Yeah. Our thoughts are with him and his family and the brave protesters fighting for their freedom against an evil regime. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I know the Home Secretary will be making a statement today on the West Midlands Police. The first thing that she should be announcing is the sacking of the Chief Constable. Yeah. And I thank the member for West Suffolk for relentlessly pushing this issue. Mr. Speaker, can I welcome the Prime Minister's latest U-turn? I feel like I say that every week. Mandatory digital ID was a rubbish policy, and we on this side of the House are glad to see the back of it. Yeah. But yesterday, the Health Secretary said the Prime Minister's New Year's resolution should be, and I quote, to try to get it right first. Yes, you did say that. My question is, does he agree?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm determined to make it harder for people to work illegally in this country. And that's why there will be checks, they will be digital, and they will be mandatory. And I'll tell her what this government is doing, whether on planning, child poverty, employment rights, investing in our NHS, we're taking the right choices for Britain, and they oppose every single one of them. And she talks about U-turns and consistency. From the party that used to recognise the challenge of climate change, and now they run from it, who promised to cut immigration, but then lost control of it, who once took great pride in our diversity, now they talk of deporting our neighbours to achieve cultural coherence. And Mr. Speaker, on consistency, don't get me started on 5 Prime Ministers, 6 Chancellors, 8 Home Secretaries, 16 Housing Ministers. They had more positions in 14 years than the Kama Sutra. No wonder they're knackered and they left the country screwed.
Kevin Bairdnoch.
A lot of waffle, Mr. Speaker, but it's still a U-turn. The member for Hull East has said, so interesting, Mr. Speaker, Labour MPs must think very carefully before defending policy decisions publicly. He said, and I quote, this stuff leaves us looking really stupid. I'm sorry to tell him, but Labour MPs have been looking stupid for a long time. But let's look, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, let's look at some other things the Prime Minister didn't get right first time, starting with the family farms tax. Some farmers were so terrified, they sold their farms last year only for the Prime Minister to U-turn 2 days before Christmas. Will he apologise for the misery he's caused countless farmers?
Mr. Speaker, the principle we put in place on inheritance tax is the right one. We listened, we made an ushering. But what we're doing is turning the country around. Yes, we've changed the country. We've changed the failed approach of the last Tory government. They crashed the economy and sent mortgage rates through the roof. They left millions stuck on NHS waiting lists. They presided over the worst Parliament for living standards on record. Now, we're turning that around. We're changing that. Inflation and interest rates are coming down. Waiting lists are coming down. Wages are up more in the first year of a Labour government than 10 years of the Tory government. But I understand, Mr. Speaker, that she's taking advice on change. She had Nadeem Zahawi in to ask his advice how to change and how to save her party. Please don't tell me she listened to his accountant. Next day after the advice, he jumped ship to reform, the 23rd former Tory MP to do so. I don't know which is more pitiful, the flood of former Tory MPs deserting her sinking ship, or the Reform Party so desperate to launder any old failed Tory politician.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister doesn't need to worry about me. I'm all right. I didn't hear an apology to the farmers. Has he even apologised to the member for Penrith, who stood up for farmers only to have the whip removed? This Prime Minister treats his MPs so badly. They follow his lead and he hangs them out to dry every time. Let's turn to another area the Prime Minister has got wrong. His budget doubled business rates for thousands of pubs. So can the Prime Minister tell us, is there going to be any change to his business rates policy?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we're working with the sector to ensure that they get the support that they need. I have to say, the Leader of the Opposition's newfound concern for pubs will come as a surprise to anyone who remembers the 7,000 pubs that were closed under the Tories. And as Business Secretary, she didn't say a word about it. So we support business, we also support workers, Mr. Speaker. And that's why we passed our Employment Rights Act. Mr. Speaker, on Monday, the Business Secretary and I went to Croydon to discuss our Employment Rights Act with workers there. They were very keen on the paternity rights and the maternity rights, which I know the Leader of the Opposition opposes. And whilst we were there at IKEA, they showed me their new prototype, the IKEA Shadow Cabinet. The trouble is, nobody wants to buy it. It's mainly constructed of old dead wood. And every time you lose a nut, it defects to reform.
Mr. Speaker, he didn't answer the question about business rates. It sounds like he doesn't know what his policy is. And this has been a farce from start to finish. On Monday, the Business Secretary said the Chancellor did not even realise the impact of her business rates policy. No surprise there. But yesterday, the Tax Office said that they did tell the government what the impact would be. So can the Prime Minister be clear? Did he understand the impact of his own policy on pubs?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we're working with this sector. She hasn't explained why she said nothing about the 7,000 pubs that closed on her watch. We're doing other things on the cost of living to help people, to make sure they can get out, to spend money in pubs and hospitality, boosting a minimum wage. What did they do? They opposed it. Freezing rail fares and prescription charges. What did they do? They opposed it. £150 off energy bills. What did they do? They opposed it. She said nothing when pubs were closing, and she opposes every measure now. And she said a moment ago, I'm all right. She clearly didn't listen to the advice of Nadeem Zahawi, because what he told her, he's now made public. He told her that they failed on mass migration, they failed on our armed forces, and he told her that she's leading, his words, a defunct brand the nation can no longer trust. No wonder he's joined the Tory migration to reform. Mr. Speaker, it's the second Boris wave.
Mr. Speaker, I asked him if he understood the impact of his own policy. He didn't say yes. The reason he U-turns all the time is because he is clueless. He is blowing around like a plastic bag in the wind, no sense of direction whatsoever. And let's be clear, Mr. Speaker, this mess goes beyond pubs. The whole of the hospitality industry, cafes, hotels, restaurants, they're all being clobbered by Labour's tax hikes. There is an answer to this. Conservatives would abolish business rates for small businesses on the high street. Mr. Speaker, yes, they're all chuntering. He's already agreeing with us on family farm tax. He's already agreeing with us on digital ID. Why doesn't he make it a hat trick and abolish business rates for the high street?
Mr. Speaker, they crashed the economy and now they want to give lectures. She's wondering why nobody's listening to them. Nobody is ever going to listen to them on the economy ever again. Mr. Speaker, in 18 months, because of the decisions we've made, inflation is falling, and the Bank of England say it's coming back down to target. We've had 6 interest rate cuts in a row. Wages are up more in the first year of a Labour government than under the first 10 years of their government. And we beat the forecast on growth for 2025. We're turning this country around after the appalling mess that they left it in.
He says no one's going to listen to us. Who's going to listen to him? The winter fuel allowance, U-turn. WASPI women, U-turn. The two-child benefit cap, U-turn. Grooming gangs inquiry, U-turn. The family farms tax, U-turn. Digital ID, U-turn. Jury trials,
U-turn.
We hope so. We hope so. I think that's going to be the next one, Mr. Speaker. Week after week, these poor people sitting behind him have to defend the indefensible, only for him to U-turn a few days later. Mr. Speaker, one of his cabinet ministers told a journalist that what's happening at the moment is extraordinarily bad. Another said, we've gone through a catastrophic series of missteps. Yet another minister said, we are so unpopular at the moment, I've come to the conclusion it's worth rolling the dice on a new leader. They're right, aren't they?
Mr. Speaker, here's the difference. I changed my party, and that's why we stand here with a majority Labour government. She sits there with her party that lost two-thirds of their MPs at the last election. And she's losing more every week. They're queuing up to join the member of Clacton's laundry service for disgraced Tory politicians. Meanwhile, inflation is down, wages are up, and waiting lists are down. Labour's turning the corner and changing this country for the better.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure you will agree, and I hope others across the chamber will also, that we need to recognise and to celebrate achievements. And I say this because across the country, knife crime offences is going down. And of course, more needs to be done, and more should be done. But this week's figures have shown that London has had its safest year ever under the London Mayor Sadiq Khan. Homicide rate in London is the lowest ever since records began. Now, Mr. Speaker, Reform and the Conservatives repeatedly talk down our capital city. So will the Prime Minister join me in saying they are wrong and will he applaud these achievements?
Well, she draws attention to the important work of the Mayor of London, and nobody should be talking our country down or talking London down. And she's right to say that since we came into office, the number of knife crime offences is down, but Mr. Speaker, there is more to do. We're introducing new powers to seize knives and increasing the penalty for selling knives to under 18s. And the party opposite, what did they do? They're chuntering. They voted against those provisions. And what's obvious about London and Reform is they've got a candidate for mayor who doesn't like London.
Yep.
A new ex-Tory recruit who struggled to pay his taxes in this country. And a leader who spends more time in France than is in his constituency.
Yeah. Sir Ed David, leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I associate myself and my party with the Prime Minister's comments on Iran? And can I encourage him to go even further on sanctions and also prescribe the IRG? Yeah. Mr. Speaker, Sandra is 71. She has bladder cancer. Just after Christmas, she went into her local A&E. She had to wait 31 hours to be admitted on a plastic trolley and in a plastic chair. Last year, more than 500,000 people waited for over 12 hours in A&E to be admitted, more than any year in the history of the NHS. Mr. Speaker, this corridor care crisis was created by the Conservatives, but it's got worse under Labour. So will the Prime Minister end this scandal by taking up our plan to end all 12-hour A&E waits this year?
Prime Minister.
Can I first say through him to Sandra that that's simply not acceptable for her or for anybody else, and I appreciate if he passes that on to her directly. We have put record investment into the NHS so we can turn this problem around, and we are turning it around. I would say to him that he puts forward his plans for change, but he never votes for the increase in investment and the measures that are needed to actually put that into practice. You can't change things without investing in them. You can't call for change and vote against a budget that puts a record investment into the NHS.
So, Ed Davey.
Mr. Speaker, we saw what happened to the last government when they failed to improve the NHS, and if the Prime Minister is not careful, that will happen to his. Mr. Speaker, last month I asked the Prime Minister to get a grip of South East Water, who'd left thousands of people in Royal Tunbridge Wells without water. Now it's happened again, not only in Tunbridge Wells, but in East Grinstead, Burgess Hill, Hayward Heath, and other parts of Kent and Sussex. Families, pensioners, schools, care homes, businesses, without any water since Saturday. And the water company bosses involved now stand accused of misleading Parliament over their failures. Mr. Speaker, South East Water keeps failing its customers over and over again. So will the government immediately strip them of their licence?
Prime Minister.
Can I thank him for raising this, because the situation is clearly totally unacceptable. He will want to know that ministers have chaired daily emergency meetings to hold the company to account to deliver on the change that's urgently needed at the moment in all the areas that he mentioned. We've also doubled the compensation rates for individuals and businesses, and we're absolutely clear the company must urgently invest in infrastructure, and we'll publish the Water White Paper in due course, but we are holding those daily meetings to hold this company to account.
Dr. Maria Timball.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm delighted by today's...
It's 21 minutes after 12. Some analysis of what you've just heard after you've listened to this.
LBC.
Private healthcare sounds pricey.
At Benenden Health, it's less than £16 per person per month.
Just for GP calls.
For a 24/7 GP helpline, physio, diagnostics and more. Now, tell me...
All about my medical history.
No medical questionnaires or hidden charges. We like to call it...
Healthcare done different.
Spot on. Benenden Health. Healthcare done different. Fee review periodically. 6-month wait for some services. T&Cs apply. Selected surgical procedures after 6 months. 24 in Northern Ireland. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
Always dreamt of running your own business? It might be easier to achieve than you think. With a franchise, you benefit from a tried and tested business model and ongoing support. Kickstart your journey to business ownership. Visit the British and International Franchise Exhibition on the 30th and 31st of January at Olympia, London. Meet exciting franchise brands, watch inspiring talks, and get free expert advice. Book your free tickets today at franchisetickets.co.uk.
The following is from TfL.
I got loads of flowers the other day and messages from people I didn't even know. My mates spelled out my name in tea lads. And my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings, next to the lamppost, where I got killed. By a nice lady, just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Live and love to the last breath. This January, fall in love with the passion, drama and heartbreak of the iconic opera that inspired Pretty Woman and Moulin Rouge. Experience the Royal Opera's grand production of La Traviata from the 8th of January to the 17th of February at the Royal Opera House. Get great seats from just £23. Don't miss La Traviata. Book now at rbo.org.uk.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It is 23 minutes after 12, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. James O'Brien and Natasha Clark, indeed, our political editor, whose predictions regarding PMQs this week were pretty close to perfect, I think.
Thanks.
Up to and including the mention of the Maccabi Tel Aviv story still unfolding in Birmingham. Here's a question that is quite hard for me to phrase fairly, because I think it's a choice between a rock and a hard place. When Kemi Badenoch calls upon Shabana Mahmood to sack the chief constable of the West Midlands Police, does she not know that the Home Secretary doesn't have that power, or is she just hoping that the public won't know and therefore she is being dishonest in pursuit of being disingenuous?
Potentially the latter, right? Obviously, I think she should know that Shabana Mahmood doesn't have that power. Potentially she doesn't.
It's feasible that she doesn't actually know that the Home Secretary doesn't hire and fire chief constable.
To be fair, I wasn't sure exactly where these police powers lay at the beginning of the day. Looked them up. It is quite evident that the police do not have this power. The Home Secretary does not have this power. Mm. Obviously, what we saw with the Prime Minister and him putting pressure on the West Midlands Police at the end of last year sort of does make you think, well, this is something that is operationally independent. It's a police forcing decision. It's meant to be something which the police make as a decision independently of politics. So Kemi Badenoch should know better. She should know that this is a policing decision, not one for the Home Secretary. But obviously, you know, chief constables do account to someone. That someone is the Police and Crime Commissioner. It's actually not the Home Secretary. So potentially she was trying to mislead, or potentially she didn't know. We'll have to ask.
Go on. Where would you put your 50p? Ignorance or dishonesty? That's what I meant about a rock and a hard.
Yeah, look, it could be either.
I'd go for ignorance.
I think probably ignorance. I think probably ignorance, because I don't think a lot of people would know that, right? I don't think a lot of people would know that this is a police and crime commissioner. Most people haven't heard of police and crime commissioners, let alone know what they do. So no. I do think it's probably a case that she doesn't know that, but she should. And yes, we are going to see this unfold later today. Shabana Mahmood is going to give a statement where what she's probably going to do is encourage him to resign and say how disappointed she is and what's happened. But she cannot sack him. And Labour obviously have vowed to scrap those police and crime commissioner roles. So then those powers, I don't know, do they go back to then the Home Secretary afterwards? Does she then get those powers back in future, potentially? So, but that was a really fun Prime Minister's questions overall, wasn't it? I was laughing away.
It was surprisingly jolly. If I had to give Badenoch any advice, I'd tell her not to laugh.
Do you think?
Or at least if she's going to laugh, make sure it sounds really sincere and authentic. But they both had some good lines. Most powerful, probably the intoned U-turns at the end. But Starmer had the best jokes.
Starmer did have the best jokes.
It was a fight, wasn't it?
Look, it was Punch and Judy politics, really, at its best there. Westminster, throwing insults, throwing bad jokes, everybody laughing, all of the backbenchers riled up. So quite a fun Prime Minister's questions. Do the public like that kind of PMQs? They always say no, but I actually think they secretly probably do enjoy it.
Do you?
Yeah, I think so.
It's really hard to tell.
I think the IKEA joke
even made Keith laugh. Yeah,
it was good. That joke about the IKEA shadow cabinet was very funny. You're right. The U-turns fuel WASPI women, two-child benefit. Mm. That all resonated. That's something that I think the backbenchers from the Tory side wanted to get behind Kemi Badenoch on. But equally, I thought Keir Starmer was very good, and he knew that she was probably going to go on this today. And he had a list of Tory U-turns that they've changed position on. And that was very strong there, talking about climate change, talking about taxes, talking about all the different things.
7,000 shut pubs is a bit of an open goal for him as well.
Oh, sure, yeah. Under the Tories' watch, one a day.
The claim that farmers had been selling their farms in order to avoid the inheritance tax. Do we know who they would be selling them to?
It's a good point, and yeah, I don't...
Presumably farmers.
Yeah, well, somebody's got to be buying, unless you're selling off the land completely and you're deciding not to use it as farmland anymore, potentially. But she didn't really go into that. She didn't talk about those figures, so it's sort of unclear.
I think that might change the tax situation if you're not selling... And yeah, I don't know. But
probably,
anyway,
yeah.
It doesn't affect the... I mean, again, I might do a text vote on whether we think she was too ignorant to know.
Potentially, yeah.
Or was being too dishonest. And I mean, that was it, really.
Yeah, and Keir Starmer, I thought, obviously, you know, he keeps talking about the cost of living crisis. He keeps talking about money in your pocket. And you heard him talking about prescription fees. You heard him talking about £150 off bills. He is really, really going to be ramming this message down our throats, I think, for the next 4 months. And to be fair, he should. That is exactly what he should be doing ahead of the locals, talking about how he's actually focusing on what the nation says.
Yeah. I don't know where that came from for me just before just after you came into the studios. I did just find myself thinking, it's two PMQs. There's the pantomime element of it, which, as you say, people do or do not find entertaining, and I suppose part of that will depend on how entertaining these non-natural entertainers actually manage to be. But then there's the pertinence point, or the relevance point, and I don't know how relevant all of this today is.
But he was making...
He was trying to drag it back to relevance
exactly.
All the time.
And arguably that's, I think, a good one for him to do. The argument... Britain is turning a corner, we're turning Britain around. I don't know how much people feel that that's true, but,
got a lot of time.
No, it's not a lot of time. He's not had very long in power to do that. And obviously change takes time and people are so impatient. Do people believe that they're turning things around?
Change of approach with Farage as well. A lot more mentions of him, which will delight Farage, of course, because nothing delights him like attention.
He's sitting in the Prime Minister's questions today. He's not... from above, as in he's in the House of Commons, he's actually listening to...
Is he still boycotting the BBC?
We don't know about that.
We were supposed to be keeping an eye on that. We were supposed to be keeping... But I like that line about a laundry service for disgraced conservatives.
Yeah, that was very funny.
It's true.
Yeah, it was very funny. We had some attacks on reform. We also had from Ed Davey, didn't we? Some sort of red on yellow action today, didn't we? Which we don't usually see. And that's sort of what struck me from that Ed Davey speech that I went to yesterday, was just how scathing he was being about the Labour government, saying this is all under your watch and things have got worse. I think that's where we're heading towards ahead of these local elections, ahead of a general election, where they're going to start turning each other almost as much as Keir Starmer is going to start turning on the Reform Party.
Can I give you some homework?
Of course.
We're going to have to talk about Wales.
We're going to have to talk about Wales.
Aren't we? It's getting very exciting, or at least very interesting.
Which aspect? Where would you like me to go?
The shift in the support and the possibility of a Plaid Cymru Senate. Apparently Farage is on with Laura Koonsberg on.
I was going to say that to you. He's on with Laura Koonsberg as part of...
But he's boycotting the BBC.
Not anymore. That didn't last 5 minutes.
He said he was boycotting the BBC until they apologised for, I don't know, hurty words or upsetting.
Maybe one of us should text Laura and that could be her first question.
Can we find out why? Or when the BBC apologised? Unless, of course, Farage was just lying again. Which I'd probably put my money on. 12:30 is the time. Amelia Cox is here with your headlines.
The head of West Midlands Police has admitted AI was used in a report which led to Maccabi Tel Aviv fans being banned from a match. Craig Guildford has apologised for giving MPs false evidence and says there was no intention to mislead. Officials in Iran say there will be expedited trials and executions for people detained in anti-government protests. Donald Trump's warned the US will take very strong action if people are killed. And Kemi Badenoch has welcomed the government's latest U-turn, saying its plans for mandatory digital ID for workers was rubbish. Starmer says he is determined to make it harder for people to work illegally and insists there will be mandatory ID checks. LBC weather, breezy and cloudy in the west and northwest with spells of rain spreading eastward. Mostly bright elsewhere, but cloudier later with light rain in the south, a high of 9 degrees.
LBC.
If you want all the best stories to tell, Best at Travel will provide the inspiration. For 40 years, our UK-based travel experts have been creating tailor-made luxury holidays. We are real people, passionate about making luxury travel personal, helping create your perfect trip. Secure your 2026 holiday today in the Best at Travel New Year sale. You can speak to one of our experts or book online at bestattravel.co.uk. Rated excellent on Trustpilot. Atoll protected.
If you were a workplace pension provider, would you grab profits for your shareholders? We wouldn't.
And we don't. Because at People's Pension, we don't even have shareholders. That's why over the last 5 years, we've given £100 million back to our members instead. Meaning more money in your pot. People's Pension. Now that's a pension with purpose. Visit peoplespension.co.uk/giveback.
When we're little, we don't overthink things. We're brave, confident, we laugh and ask questions.
And play!
And play. So why stop there? Just because we're adults, it shouldn't mean we stop trying new things. For me, starting a career in early years has meant not just a new job, but new skills, new friends.
Like me?
Yes, and a new sense of purpose. All that, and I can earn while I learn, right here in Surrey.
Yay, painting next!
Do something big. Work with small children. Search early years careers to find out more.
What would you do if you found a way to make endless money? In a damp flat in Blackpool, James Parker did just that. He discovered a way to make Bitcoin out of thin air, and it made him rich beyond his wildest dreams. But that's when the trouble started. Join me, Lewis Goodall, for my new podcast, Coining It, the true story of a man who found a crack in the system and created a fortune that tore lives apart. Listen for free on Global Player, download it from the App Store or head to globalplayer.com.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 33 minutes after 12. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Just trying to get to the bottom of what happened to Nigel Farage's pledge to boycott the BBC after they asked him about the extraordinary number of former pupils and classmates at Dulwich College who recall him being hideously racist, up to and including suggesting to Jewish pupils who had lost family in the Holocaust that Hitler was right, making gas chamber sound effects. He promised he was going to boycott the BBC until they apologised for that. Well, I'm delighted to tell you that Nigel's rung in to clear this up because I'm a little bit confused. And here he is.
Bernard Manning.
Oh. And while I have you, if I may, a little word on this new depiction of your party as being a laundry service for disgraced Tories.
My message to you is clear, plain and simple. Never trust a Tory. Did you get that? I'll repeat it. Never trust a Tory. They will always let you down. They will always betray you.
Interesting. Speaking of trust, I am rejoined now by Chloe Hadjimatheu, who you will recall, or if you don't, I will fill you in, as the journalist with The Observer, who has been digging into this extraordinary backstory to one of the most successful literary events of the last few years, The Salt Path, a tale of triumph over adversity, of battling misery and prevailing, but which, as Chloe has previously established, the truth of which appeared to be very different from what had been presented to readers. Do you want to give us a quick, like, as if this were an episode of Quantum Leap or Dallas? Actually, let me just bring that up to date for younger viewers. As if this were an episode of Succession or Industry. Do you want to just remind us of the story so far, Chloe? It's lovely to see you.
Good to see you. Last time I was here, I was telling you that I had discovered that the origin story in The Salt Path essentially tells the story of Rhaina Wynne and her husband, Moth, and how they lost their home in Wales because they were conned out of it by a friend of theirs in a dodgy business deal. And then within a week, they'd found out that Moth had a degenerative, fatal neurological disease. And they took this extraordinary decision to walk the Southwest Coastal Path, during which nature, the walk itself, and their kind of love for each other had this incredible impact on his condition and sort of reversed his symptoms. And she went on to write two further books, which were also top of the Sunday Times bestseller list. And there's now been a movie about this. And last summer, I uncovered that the way in which they lost their house was not correct. What had actually happened was Rhaina Wynne, whose real name is Sally Walker, had been accused of stealing money from her employer, over 60,000 in Wales, back in 2008. She was arrested and then borrowed money against her home to repay her employer and essentially get out of a criminal investigation, and subsequently lost her home when she couldn't pay that loan off. There were also serious questions about Moth's condition and his claims to, and her claims that he could cure it.
Not least from people with the same condition.
People with the same condition, and also neurologists who specialise in this very rare condition, claimed that they'd never seen anybody display the symptoms that he had, have the condition for as many years as he's had it, and be able to halt let alone reverse the symptoms. That was last summer. Since then, I wrote an article in The Observer. Since then, I have been in touch with Raina Wynn's family and Moth's families, and they have even more stuff to tell. Four members of each family have spoken to me, and the story that I have got is that, in fact, Raina Wynn and Moth were never destitute without anywhere to live. They did lose their home, but they were then taken in by family, and they lived with Raina Wynn's niece for about 18 months, during which they went on walking holidays, as people do. It seems they didn't walk the Southwest Coastal Path in the way in which they claimed in the book, but over a series of years during walking holidays, like most people do it. Also, the families claim that Raina Wynn emptied the bank accounts of Moth's parents and her own mother. And they presented me, her niece presented me with an apparent confession letter in which Raina Wynn admits stealing over £60,000 from her employer and stealing money from her husband's parents and leaving them with that, unable to pay their own rent, and also faking her mum's bank statements and stealing money from her own mum. I should say very quickly here that Raina Wynn has said on her website that she has not stolen any money and that she did not write a confession letter.
So she is essentially accusing her niece of forgery at this point.
She seems to be suggesting that members of her family have access to Grind and that The Observer has in some way incited some kind of family feud.
Why, I suppose, speaking to that point, why, when you speak to family members who must have watched, if everything they're telling you is true, they must have watched this saga unfold with a curious mixture of incredulity and abject horror. Why have they not come forward sooner?
That's a really good question, and it's one that lots of people ask me. And the way in which I respond to that and the way in which they've told me is that they've tried. Yeah. So her niece actually...
Where would you go?
Well, she Googled Penguin
right.
And called some call centre and nobody took her seriously. She went to the police with this confession letter and they were like, you know, didn't want to get into a family dispute. And so they have tried, but it's been some kind of mad gaslighting experience for them where they've watched somebody they know as Sally Walker take on this persona, Raina yeah. Wynn, and become a sort of national treasure.
So where do you go? What is the hotline that you ring to
there
report?
There doesn't seem to be a mechanism.
Alleged bogusness on the part of the national treasure. So this story just gets... I mean, you must be slightly surprised, having unearthed the original, what would we call it, apparent gap between the reality and what was being presented. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, I mean... This story came to me because a member of the public sort of approached me and said, I'm concerned that the way they're presenting this man's condition and his ability to reverse it...
So just it was a medical story originally.
A medical story. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, people's medical histories are private. I wasn't sure how far I'd get. I had no idea I was going to sort of open the door to essentially what is an accusation of a gigantic heist and con.
We have contacted Sally Walker for comment. This is LBC speaking now, but we did not receive a response. There's a book as well. I mean, again, these moments where you'd have thought that a script editor might have, if you were putting this together as a work of fiction, a script editor might have occasion on... I think you're pushing the boundaries of plausibility now, Chloe. This self-published novel, I think we could probably leave that on the cutting room floor.
It's just mad. So, it turns out that Raina Wynn has always maintained that The Salt Path was an accidental book. She wrote it as a sort of notes for her husband so that he wouldn't forget their walk. She says it's the first thing she ever wrote and she never imagined she'd get it published. In fact, she self-published a novel years earlier. And this is really bizarre. This is a fictional account about a couple who buy a house in Wales. The wife steals money from her employer, flees the police, borrows against her house to repay the employer, and they lose their home in that way. Sound familiar?
Well, what you're suggesting here is that a work of fiction that she wrote is actually more accurate with regard to their shared history than the work of non-fiction that she claimed to have written.
It's bizarre. And for some reason, it seems that she was able to sort of approach the real damage she'd done, or I mean, I think this novel is actually an apology, a sort of excuse for what she's done. She tries to explain herself in this novel in some way, but she wasn't able to deal with it in a memoir of her real life. And I think the place that I reached is that Raina Wynn is an incredible creator. She's an author, but she's also created personalities. Raina, Wynne and Moth, and she's created backstories for them, potentially the stories she wished they'd had.
I just find it endlessly fascinating. I'm not entirely sure why. Is it because the scale of the success was so enormous and the number of people that were buying into something more than a book? They were buying into redemption. They were buying into hope. They were buying into some of the purest of human emotions have been so categorically misled and betrayed. That speaks to something quite primal, doesn't it?
I think so. I don't think you can really blame readers for wanting hope. The world's a exactly. bit of a miserable place these days, and so we get it wherever we can find it, right? But yes. I think, you know, Raina Wynne didn't set out to scam anyone. You can't set out to create a best-selling novel, you know, book. Yeah. This is something she stumbled across. But she went on to write a second and third. And I think really the questions are for Penguin, who haven't responded. They said they believe they did all due diligence in this case, but nobody asked any difficult questions when her stories became more and more outlandish with claims of Moth reversing his condition. And I think the message that this author received was that maybe truth isn't that important in memoir.
What will I get from your new podcast that I haven't already got from following your excellent journalism in The Observer, Chloe?
You will get a real human take on this. You'll go behind the scenes and hear people's stories in detail. You'll live it slowly as the investigation unraveled for me.
And you're not finished yet.
Well, I bloody hope I am, well, James.
I don't imagine what might happen next.
I don't know if she's got any more skeletons in her closet. I hope not, because I'm moving on now. I've got other stories to do.
And have you had any meaningful contact from her?
I haven't.
Any back channel contact?
And it's a real shame because I've reached out to her, probably about a dozen times, requesting an interview, requesting a meeting, a conversation. And I think that's really what's missing from this story is Raina's perspective on all this. I'd love to hear from her. So whether it's me or to someone else, it would be great to hear her side of these events.
Thank you. What's the podcast called?
The podcast is called The Walkers, The Real Salt Path, and you can find it on Tortoise Investigates.
You can also find it on The Global Player. Or indeed wherever you get your podcasts, which I believe is obligatory to add at the end of comments like that. Chloe, lovely to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find the back catalogue of that investigation on the Observer website, or of course you can listen to the brand new podcast. It is 12:15. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, and Simon Marks will be joining us next for a quick update on, can work out for yourself where he's likely to begin or indeed end. And while we're at it, what on earth might be in the middle with regard to the political situation on the other side of the Atlantic?
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
President Trump warns Iran over protesters. What's likely to happen next? Sir Keir Starmer is turned over U-turns. And will West Midlands Police lose its chief constable over Maccabi lies?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Upgrade your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and reset your gut health with Biotiful. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
Get as much cash as you get your hands on a meeting at the Halsey.
Marty Supreme is nominated for 3 Golden Globes, including Best Motion Picture, Best Screenplay, and Best Actor Timothy Chalamet.
It's every man for himself where I come from.
It's the best film of the year. 5 stars, The Telegraph. A masterpiece, IndieWire. 5 stars, The Guardian, Times, and Empire.
I don't think you understand the stakes here.
Timothy Chalamet and Gwyneth Paltrow.
What do you plan to do if this whole dream of yours doesn't work out?
It doesn't even enter my consciousness.
Maybe it should.
Marty Supreme. Cinemas everywhere now.
Whatever your day brings, Well Man and Well Woman multivitamins support your nutritional needs, including vitamin B12 to support normal energy release. Well Man and Well Woman. Live life well. From Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company. From Boots, pharmacies and vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see vitabiotics.com.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Whatever you're cooking up this year, Lidl has your back. From supporting your protein goal to your plant-powered lifestyle. Enjoy up to 20% off our chilled high protein and Vermondo plant-based ranges with Lidl Plus. So you can fuel your day your way. Lidl, more to value. 18 plus GB only, while stocks last. Terms apply, see lidl.co.uk/lptv. Offer ends 14th of 1st, 2026.
Hi babe, what a day. Fancy staying in tonight instead? Mackie's calling my name and I saw you can get £5 off if you spend £20 on the app. So you in? Of course you are. Okay, bye.
Exclusively on the McDonald's app. Save £5 when you spend £20 on food and drink via delivery. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. Service and delivery fees apply. Valid once per week, 1st to the 31st of January. Participating restaurants. Serving times apply.
Leading Britain's conversation. LBC with James O'Brien.
It's 12:47. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. A quick shout to Helen, actually, who spent the best part of 2 hours desperately racking her brains after taking seriously my request to try to remember some of the features that we launched and quite enjoyed on this programme and then completely forgot about, which is all the features, except completely. I mean, we tend to remember some of them, but you're right, Smear Keir. Do you remember Smear Keir? I think it only worked when he was in opposition, didn't it? But he was being lampooned and attacked and lambasted for everything from buying a field for his disabled mother so she could look after donkeys. That was one of the worst things that he did. And then sundry other completely innocuous things being attacked for by journalists who had excused all the truly hideous things that Boris Johnson did as an actual prime minister. We've still got the production. I've told you before, it takes me months, years to get it, and then I use it, and then I forget it. So just to give a shout out to the people who actually get paid to produce this stuff. This is what that used to sound like. That was one of the most sophisticated pieces of production, I think, that we didn't make it. We got it sent in by a listener. We outsourced it, technically speaking. And we are not outsourcing our coverage of American politics. We rely upon family for that. And Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent, is with me. We'll start with the head of the Fed, Simon. We'll start with Jerome Powell, because it's probably the best example today of stuff that would have been absolutely front and center and deadly serious and all that we could talk about under any other president, but under Donald Trump, it's just one on a long list of things that we might.
Yes, absolutely, James. This is, of course, Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, America's independent central bank. The Federal Reserve, of course, sets monetary policy here in the United States with vast implications for the rest of us all around the world without political interference from the White House or from Congress. And what Jerome Powell learnt on Friday was that he was the subject of a criminal investigation being launched by a Trump-appointed U.S. attorney here in the District of Columbia, and not any Trump-appointed U.S. attorney. Her name is Jeanine Pirro, And that name may ring bells for some of our listeners, because she was, during the Biden administration, one of the most outspoken, loud-mouthed personalities on Fox News, openly supportive of President Trump. She's a former judge in Westchester County in New York. So her reward was to be appointed to this U.S. attorney's position in the District of Columbia, and she issued subpoenas unprecedented to the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell becoming the first ever Fed chair to come under criminal investigation in what is undoubtedly a trumped-up investigation into the amount of money the Fed has spent renovating its headquarters here in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump has a real bugbear about it. He actually confronted Jerome Powell on camera several months ago, presenting Jerome Powell in a kind of almost a Volodymyr Zelensky moment, with a bill of particulars, the president claiming that the money's all been misspent, and Jerome Powell on camera, caught by surprise, looks at this document and says, "No, Mr. President, you've got this wrong, because you've included the costs of another building that isn't part of these renovations at all." Nonetheless, Jeanine Pirro has clearly taken her cue from the White House, knows that Donald Trump wants to get rid of Jerome Powell, knows that he actively wants to control the Fed, wants to put a pliant Fed chair in who will take his calls and act on his commands when the President of the United States picks up the phone and tells the Fed chair to lower interest rates. He wants a Fed chair who's going to snap to attention. What I think they didn't count on was the reaction to all of this. And it's looking very clear that Jeanine Pirro's overreached. And I think the White House is in shock over the reaction, because on Capitol Hill, even among normally loyal supporters of President Trump, Republicans are recoiling from it. And of course, around the world, so are other central bank governors, issuing a stark warning of what's going to happen if Jerome Powell is ousted over this. But of course, they're still going to have to deal with the fact that in May, Jerome Powell is leaving office and Donald Trump's about to name his successor. And it will be a man who does Donald Trump's bidding.
Who nominated Jerome Powell for the job back in 2017?
Yes. Well, extraordinarily, it was a man called Donald Trump. But he doesn't talk very much about that anymore. Instead, he blames Joe Biden for keeping Jerome Powell on. What this is an effort to pierce the independence of one of the last institutions standing here in the United States. And I think it's important to underscore, James, that all of this was playing out yesterday at the very moment that six prosecutors with the Department of Justice were resigning their posts in Minneapolis because they were being ordered by the no longer independent Department of Justice here in Washington to investigate not the killer ICE agent who shot Renee Nicole Good dead last week, but Ms. Good's widow. They were being ordered to investigate the widow and to see what kind of connections she had to that underground conspiracy of far-left radicals that Donald Trump claims are trying to stop ICE and the Border Patrol from their thuggish tactics on the streets of America. So the Department of Justice, traditionally independent, that's already gone. That is his Bureau of Personal Retribution. The Fed, still independent, clinging on, and will, I think, until May, but after May, don't count on it.
I'm tempted to get you to say that last bit again, but I won't. The Department of Justice investigating the widow of the woman who was shot in the face and lied about by Donald Trump and all of his cronies while praising and offering hero status to the man who killed her. And
specifically telling those prosecutors that they were not to investigate the killer ICE agent. I mean, so six of them walked out yesterday. And, you know, we've seen similar incidents taking place in other parts of the country with DOJ officials quitting. But the Department of Justice at this point, like so many other institutions, completely enthrall to the president.
Speaking of ICE, the extraordinarily popular YouTuber Joe Rogan, who was widely regarded as having played quite a key part in delivering some votes to Donald Trump, has been unexpectedly outspoken on the killing of Renee Nicole Good.
Yes, he has. He was doing an interview with the Libertarian Republican Senator Rand Paul, who is very hostile towards ICE and this and its operations around the country. I mean, he comes at it from a different perspective of being hostile to big government. He wants a really small government. And Joe Rogan became very outspoken. He asked if the United States, are we really going to be like the Gestapo? He asked, he said that ICE is operating all over the country illegally. He said that the killing of Renee Nicole Good was very ugly, horrific, and in a fresh challenge to all of those Trump supporters out there who keep insisting that Renee Nicole Good was trying to kill the ICE agent, trying to ram him with her car. Even Joe Rogan takes the view that she was kind of turning the car away at the time that she was shot by that ICE agent. And I think this does indicate that, as we've talked about before on the program, James, there is a moment at which the things that Donald Trump and his henchmen and women are doing all over the country are so profoundly un-American that someone like Joe Rogan, who I think would, you know, absolutely characterize himself as a proudly American patriot, not in the political sense that Donald Trump uses that patriot word, people look at what happened on the streets of Minneapolis last week and think that it was profoundly un-American, and it is profoundly un-American that there is going to be absolutely no sanction on that killer ICE agent. And I think it's a challenge for those people that are still out there insisting that, as the Vice President of the United States put it last week, it was a justified killing of Renee Nicole Good by that ICE agent because she was trying to attack law enforcement officers. There is not a shred of evidence to support that contention.
And unlikely ever will be. Final word, and it'll have to be brief, on somebody, I think in Detroit, finally managing to speak a little bit of truth to power.
So Donald Trump was touring a Ford manufacturing plant yesterday, and it didn't go entirely according to plan because one of the people watching on from up above, possibly a Ford employee, possibly someone else who was just at the factory, started screaming at Donald Trump that he was a pedophile protector. At which point Donald Trump engaged with eye contact with the man, gave him the middle finger, and mouthed more than once that the man should F off, a response that the White House has described as appropriate given the circumstances. I think what it does is underscore that the Jeffrey Epstein issue is not going away. For all of the distraction we've seen, Venezuela, Greenland, Iran, everything that's been going on, the Jeffrey Epstein issue and the fact that Donald Trump's pliant Department of Justice is still sitting on 2 million documents they are legally required to put into the public domain is seen by many Americans as a core issue, and they view what Trump is doing as distraction, they believe, part of a cover-up of what Epstein was up to and what Donald Trump's relationship was with him.
Simon Marks, many thanks indeed. That is such an important observation at the end there, that it will all still be there, regardless of how many wars he starts or invasions he undertakes or presidents he kidnaps. It will all still be there, and people are increasingly concerned by it. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player or on the LBC app, where you can stay up to date on all the top stories and opinions. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from this show every day. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Sawbrick coming up at 4 on LBC, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much indeed, James. The three today. Will the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police still be in his job by tea time? At 2, Margaret Thatcher famously said, "You turn if you want to." This lady or the lady's not for turning. Her Conservative successor as party leader said this at Prime Minister's Questions today.
The two-child benefit cap, U-turn. Grooming gangs inquiry, U-turn. The family farms tax, U-turn. Digital ID, U-turn.
It really doesn't look good, does it? She's got a very fair point when she makes that point. But I'm going to start with Iran and President Trump and those constant threats to act and to take care of the Iranian regime in the face of those protests. What should happen next? And should he stop warning and start acting?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the head of West Midlands Police has admitted AI was used in a report which led to Maccabi Tel Aviv fans being banned from a match against Aston Villa. Craig Guildford says there was no intention to mislead MPs about a security threat. The report included references to a game between the Israeli club and West Ham that never happened. LBC's political editor Natasha Clark says it will be hard for him to stay in the job.
There is a lot of pressure on him to quit. And of course, it's been a very hot topic in Westminster too. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has said West Midlands police have capitulated to Islamists in the decision to ban those fans.
Iran's top judge has signalled the trials and executions of anti-government protesters will be expedited. Donald Trump has warned he'll take very strong action if executions take place. Keir Starmer has insisted there will be checks on the right to work in the UK after being accused of another government U-turn. Ministers are reportedly preparing to water down plans for a new mandatory digital ID system. Kemi Badenoch has accused the government of having no sense of direction following recent climb downs over business rates for pubs. The Prime Minister has told the Commons the Tories are being hypocritical.
Five Prime Ministers, six Chancellors, eight Home Secretaries, 16 Housing Ministers. They had more positions in 14 years than the Kama Sutra. No wonder they're knackered and they left the country screwed.
Plans have been revealed to build a new railway line between Birmingham and Manchester, but the government has given no timescale for the project. It will come after major rail upgrades across the north of England, including east to west connections. And 17,000 properties in Kent and Sussex remain without water. South East Water has apologised, saying supply has been restored to around 8,000 homes and work is continuing. It's blamed leaks and burst pipes following the recent cold weather. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 36 points at 10,173. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, breezy and cloudy in the west and northwest with spells of rain spreading eastward. Mostly bright elsewhere, but cloudier later with light rain in the south, a high of 9 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
What's the secret to feeling young? Cryo chambers, vampire facials, forest bathing? Really? The real secret to feeling young? Simply living young. And with a new Seat Ibiza, you can roll young with a £2,000 Seat contribution. Or the new Seat Arona with a £3,000 Seat contribution. Both at 6.9% APR representative. Seat, rolling young. With solutions PCP, ordered by 31st of March 2026. Indemnities may be required. Seat Finance.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I will be talking a little later in the programme about Keir Starmer's various U-turns that were thrown in his face in Prime Minister's questions, understandably. We'll talk about that after two. We're also awaiting on a decision by Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary over a report by MPs which was highly critical of the decision-making of the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police. That's due in about 2:30, 2:45. So we'll bring the detail of that to you when it comes, and we're going to discuss it after three as well. But I very much want to begin with Iran. As you'll know, I was off for the last 2 days, but you could not and perhaps should not escape the detail of what's going on in Iran. US President Donald Trump, as I'm sure you know by now, has urged Iranian anti-government protesters to keep protesting, saying a number of times, help is on its way. We don't know precisely what he means by help when he says help is on its way, what he's leaning towards, and when that might come. Here to discuss it with me, before I discuss it with you, and I can see already that people are texting in and calling in on this, because I know we have a big Iranian community in the UK for starters, but it is such an important geopolitical situation that we find ourselves in, let alone the horrors and the dangers that the people on the ground in Iran themselves are facing. Dan Anami joins me, an Iranian-born Kurdish activist and human rights defender who spent her life fighting for women's rights, freedom and equality. She fled Iran after the 1979 Islamic Revolution due to political persecution and settled here in the UK. She's the founder of the Iranian and Kurdish Women's Rights Organization, now called IKWRO, Women's Rights Organization. And we'll speak to another guest in just a moment, Dr. Roxanne Farmayan. Diana, first of all, it's been an intensely difficult few days, I'm sure, to be an Iranian far from Iran and watching these events unfold. Describe to me what you think the most pressing thing is at the moment, the most urgent thing is at the moment.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me to your program. It is a really very difficult situation, especially for us who are abroad and haven't couldn't reach people in Iran as we did before because of the internet blackout. And we heard about massacre. We heard about the difficulty killing thousands of people and making blood scream, which I understand for the regime, for the terrorist Islamic regime, it is the battle of life and death for them. And knowing them to stick in power with teeth and nails for the past 47 years, it is the way they stick in power, by oppressing people and by killing people, by terrorizing people, massacring people. But despite all of that, people still are coming to the street, people still defending their life, their freedom, and struggling for that and fighting for that, and didn't accept what they have done to them over this past few years.
And people might remember, I certainly do, the largely women's protesting that took place a few years ago, back in 2022, supported by many men as well, it's important to say. This past fortnight or so has been different, hasn't it? Many more sections of society have come out in these protests.
Definitely, yes. I can say that this is the continuation of all the other uprising that has been done after the revolution. And it is the biggest, actually the largest uprising after the revolution in 97 that happened in Iran. And people from different pathway come to the street, from women who are asking for equality, for freedom, against poverty, against the oppression, against for freedom of the political, free of the political prisoners in Iran. And, you know, people has nothing to do, nothing to lose, let's say, in Iran to come to the demonstration. So from women to children, and mainly young people are in the street because they don't see any future for themselves. And they cannot stay and live under this terrorizing regime that has they experienced in their life. Because they open their eyes, they have contact with via internet, they see different world, they see European, they see America and other countries, that people live a life with safety and freedom. So
they want it. They want it.
Yeah. They deserve to have
that. They want it, and you perhaps remember it.
Exactly, exactly. We had some kind of freedom during the Shah time, which it was, of course, in my opinion, I was one of those people that at that time I was young as well, teenager, and I was one of the people that organized demonstration against Shah time, because at that time it was also dictatorship. Although the women, we had freedom to wear what we wanted to wear, but it was not all the freedom they wanted. We from the Kurdish